8 o'clock, am I on up now?
I think we're in pretty good shape on irrigation.
My name's Steve Flinders. I'm the chair. I represent the Fish Lake and Dixie National Forest. Anybody on that side of the room, that the screen's facing the rack, you may have some trouble seeing that screen. If you want to see the presentations, you may want to shift over to the middle or this other side. Let's introduce the rack, starting on my left, Fordell.
I'm Cordell Pearson from Circabelle, representing at large.
Mac Morrell, Bicknell, representing agriculture.
Mike Staley, Delta, at large.
Dale Bagley from Marysville, representing an elected official.
Lane Torgerson from Ridgefield, I'm a sportsman representative.
Mike Worthen from Cedar City at large.
Bruce Bonebreak, I'm the regional supervisor here for the Division of Wildlife.
Rusty Aiken, Cedar City Agriculture.
Brian Johnson, Enoch, non-consumptive.
Sam Carpenter from Kanab, I represent sportsmen.
Harry Barber from Kanab, represent the BLM, taking over for Paul Briggs in the future.
Dave Black from St. George, representing at-large.
Well, welcome Harry back to the rack. Been a few years. Good to see you, Harry. I want to recognize Jake Albright in the audience tonight. Jake's a wildlife board member. Let me talk about the meeting order tonight, and then we'll get into the agenda. There'll first be a presentation from the Division of Wildlife. We'll take questions from the rack, and then questions from the public. Try to make sure you pose them as questions and try to keep them to a couple of questions if you would. Sometimes we get carried on with questions. We want to hear your comments and we want your questions answered, but we want to be able to proceed through this agenda, if that makes sense. After questions from the rack and the public, we'll then proceed to comments. Please fill out a comment card, get it to the front. Let us know which agenda item you wish to speak to. We'll then proceed to comments from the RAC members and proceed to motions and voting. With that, the RAC members will take a look at the agenda. I'll accept a motion on the agenda and the meeting minutes from last month.
I'll make a motion we accept the minutes from last month as written.
Thanks, Dale. Seconded by Brian. All in favor? It's unanimous. Moving on to the wildlife board update. I've been to a number of wildlife boards, and this one was unique in a few ways. It started with me leaving at Beaver at 5:15 and not getting to the board meeting until nearly 11 o'clock. There were two fatalities on I-15 that day. Traffic was something else. We had a number of things that we passed as a rack that didn't make it through the wildlife board process. I say that they didn't make it through necessarily the way that we intended or the way that we passed them here. Let me go through those. I'll try to be brief, but I want to give some explanation. And if you need other explanations, some of you are interested more than others, that recording is available on the division's website. You can listen to the board meeting verbatim, listen to discussion that goes on amongst the board members. Let me real quick talk about a couple of action log items. The For those of you who aren't aware, the Wildlife Board has an action log. It's sort of a something that goes on behind the scenes where division personnel often are asked to work on these items and bring them forward at a later date. We've sometimes requested special things be added to the action log. These are the items that passed. That the division look into a premium limited entry deer tag, similar to the premium limited entry elk tag. The division look into the possibility and feasibility of a limited entry turkey permit holder who is unsuccessful, that they can turn in their limited entry tag and purchase a general season tag. The next motion deals with the deer management plan. As you recall, we asked for 4 units be placed in a higher buck to doe ratio category, 20 to 25, and Jake took a stab at that. It was seconded by John Baer, but failed in a vote 4-2, and in the end, the board unanimously passed the recommendations by the division for deer in terms of buck to doe ratios and permit numbers. And the rationale I rewrote, there was a lot of discussion about we can fine tune this later, let's just start this process and see how, kick this ball down the road and see what happens. The board adopted our reduction in Mount Dutton limited entry bull elk tags, 110. Next motion was on the Manti, a reduction, a compromise at 406. For limited entry bulls. Next one's on the book list. I'm not sure how many people are interested. It's 130 limited entry on the book lists. The beaver unit was reduced by 5 limited entry bull elk tags that be distributed across the weapon types. Let me pause right here. This is due to a depredation situation that is taking place in the beaver unit. And what I want to make sure tonight, there are a lot of players in the room on both sides of that issue, and let's not digress and talk about this. I don't think anything positive can come out of it. The board did what they did. The situation happened between the RAC meeting and the board meeting. So this has to do with depredation law, depredation policy rule, none of which is on the agenda tonight. So let's focus on what's on the agenda, please. The next motion was to pass the bucks, bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime recommendations as presented, you know, what remained. And the analyst permit recommendations, this was discussed for over an hour. As you recall, we asked for an increase in the antelope permits and 500 analyst permits on the fish lake. Those are 2 hunts that the director used his emergency authority, as you recall, in the last few years to cancel or change hunts. The flight data this year was discussed, you know, that given the conditions were poor, the flight data still wasn't where the division would like it to have been. And Ernie Perkins took a stab at 250 permits, and the motion failed. So the analyst recommendations were as the division recommended. CWMUs were recommended, as well as everything else there. So unless somebody has any questions about the Wildlife Board update, again, if you want lots of detail, you can listen to the whole thing. Sure, Sam.
Yeah, I'd like to comment just a couple of things on that. And one of the things that I think a lesson learned here is when we make recommendations as RAC, we need to go to that meeting and represent that. The motions that we carried that were voted down didn't make it because there really wasn't any support up there from anyone other than Jake and Steve. And I want to thank them. They did a real fine job of trying to get our stuff put through as we voted on it down here. But we've got new board members. We've got new people up there. And if we've got something we feel strongly about on this RAC, it's going to be up to us to make sure that we're up there to represent what we feel and why we feel these changes or whatever need to be made. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions about the board meeting? Seeing none, I'll turn the mic over to Bruce for a regional update.
Okay, don't have a lot of personnel changes this last time. I know the last meeting I spent quite a bit of time on it. Really, the only one this time is, I guess it's official that I'm the regional supervisor now for the Southern Region. I've got some dates I'd like to throw out, a couple things going on. We have a Panguitch Lake Management Plan public meeting, and that'll be tomorrow at the Panguitch High School. It starts at, I'm not sure when it starts.
6 o'clock.
Okay. And then we have a mule deer study on Monroe Mountain meeting. It's on May 17th. We'll be talking about the collared fawns and coyotes that they're going to do for that study. That will be right here in Richfield at the courthouse, at the county courthouse, at 7 p.m. on, like I said, May 17th. Yes. On 250 North Main. Okay. Okay, so that's where it'll be at May 17th at the old courthouse, 250 North Main. Okay, and then we also have a coming up May 29th, we have a coyote open house that'll be at the Crystal Inn in Cedar City. And I don't know if we've came up with the time of that yet, but there will be an announcement out on it. May 29th, we'll be at the Crystal Inn. I think it's going to be at 6, but I'm not positive of that. Teresa, do you know what time that coyote meeting starts? Don't know. 7?
I don't know.
Okay. Other update items. We had a major problem with and I think I mentioned it last month, with a quagga mussel problem down at Lake Powell. They had stopped a boat called the Fiesta Queen. It was a huge paddle wheeler that was headed for Canada. Luckily, we got it diverted at Lake Powell. The owner was very easy to work with, but it took quite a bit of time to decontaminate that, and it had like three engines and engine compartments, and it was full of quagga mussels. So, our fisheries guys deserve a lot of praise for taking care of that problem. And lastly, let's see, what else do I have here? We're going to have a quagga mussel check station again this month. It'll be May 11th, Friday, and it'll be 3:30 to 8:30 p.m. That'll be at the Bloomington station again. We did one last month, and it's working good. Fortunately, we haven't had to stop too many boats that have had problems, but we've had pretty good compliance, and it seems to be getting the word out. The other states have been, especially north of us, where these boats are going through that don't have quagga mussels, are very interested in working with us on that. And then I wanted to mention that Navajo Lake will probably be mostly drained by July this year. The dike has the water level has finally got down to the dike. The dike hole is huge. It's washed out the bottom. There's about 4 feet of water in that lake right now. We're going to try to get out an emergency fishing reg to allow people to keep 8 fish out of there. The fishing is excellent there now. If anybody wants to go fishing, it's really good, but it won't last. And lastly, I wanted to mention I mentioned them last time. I want to mention them again. The two road ecology projects that we got going, major ones down here now. And that's the fencing south of Cedar City and US 89 over in the Ponsagant. I'm at a meeting with DOT today. They're working on the design on the Ponsagant one. That will be due to start. Probably won't be starting out till this winter. But those two projects, there were three RAC members that are here that were integral in getting money and funding for those. And I've got a little award I'd like to give to them. It's not much. It's some of the division coins, and I just wanted to honor those. So on the Ponsagant project, Rusty Akins and Sam Carpenter were integral in that, and I want to thank you guys for working on that. And on the fencing project south of Cedar, it just amazes me that we're going to have that thing completed probably by June. the way that thing's going along. And Mike Worthen with the county, Iron County, was integral in working on that. And if it hadn't been for Mike, I don't think we'd ever got the money. I know one thing for sure, it would never been completed in that time period. So, again, Mike, hand that down to Mike. Oh, there's Mike. These guys, I mean, they've done such good things for wildlife. We've saved a lot of animals having those fencing projects, and we've got the right mitigation in them as far as allowing the animals to go under the freeway with what was available there. The Ponce Development, of course, will be building structures, but the escape ramps, it's all state-of-the-art stuff, and it works. And so thank you, guys. That's all I had.
Thanks. Any questions for Bruce? Seeing none, let's get into the meat of things. Agenda item number 5, deer management plans. Teresa.
All right, hopefully I can figure out this iPad. I will be discussing both the deer and elk management plans. Tap, right? All right, we'll start with deer. This is just a map of the deer units that we've got in the southern region. We've got 12 units. The Fillmore is broken up into the two subunits, as well as the Plateau, broken up into the Fish Lake, Thousand Lake, and Boulder, although we did combine the Boulder and Kaparowitz as one unit. Each of the units have a plan, and they contain boundary description. They have land ownership, acreage. It's broken up into year-long, summer, winter range, habitat. Each plan will address the population objectives and different strategies to reach those. Also habitat objectives and strategies. And then it also goes through the range trend studies that we have. Once every 5 years, the range trend hits our region. They rotate throughout the 5 regions of the state, so every 5 years they end up in the southern region. And when they do that, they evaluate all the sites, the permanent range trend sites, and they come up with what's called the DCI ranking, or the Desired Component Index. And it is a measurement of the condition of the deer winter range and how it relates to the potential carrying capacity. If it's in really poor condition, we have implemented several short-term objectives and lowered the carrying capacity on 4 of our deer units in the southern region. But as that desirable component index changes, the population can go up or down. Population objectives in the southern region, like I said, the units that currently do have a DCI reduction are the Southwest Desert at 3,200. Its long-term objective is 4,000. The Fillmore was lowered from 12,500 to 12,000. Ponsagant was 6,500 for the long-term objective, and it's currently at 5,200, and the Pine Valley. Where is the Pine Valley? It is cut off. It's at 14, and we're managing at 12,500. Anyway, the rest of the objectives are the same as the long-term objective. So, But that does show what we will be managing from 2006 to 2014. A comprehensive revision of all of our deer plans will follow 1 year after the range trend comes back to the southern region. And the range trend is slated to come back to the southern region in 2013. So you can expect to see a comprehensive revision of all the deer plans again just in 2 years. In 2014, we'll be redoing them. But we want to redo them the year after we have the most current data. So then we'll be on a 5-year rotation after that. So we'll always be a year after the range trend comes through. All right, elk. Steve, you recognize that picture?
Oh,
Okay. You want to talk about deer? Okay.
Yeah, there should be some on the table, or here's some right here.
Yeah, Teresa, I noticed on the Pine Valley unit there's a pretty substantial drop in our objective from 16,000 to 12,800. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, and that is currently, that has been in place, I believe, since 2006 because of poor DCI scores. So when the range trend came through last time, some of those plants were in bad condition. Either there's certain rankings, so if they're like poor and their condition is decreasing from the previous 5 years, we do a 20% decrease in that population. It's short term. Once the range starts to improve, but it is what we think a measurement of the carrying capacity for that population. We don't want to have more deer on that unit than the habitat can sustain, because the last thing we want to do is damage the habitat to the point where it will permanently lower the carrying capacity. So if we keep it low for a few years, if we have good conditions, get some moisture, when the range trend comes back through next year, it may be improving, and that will go back up to the long-term objective.
Thank you.
Sam.
Yeah, Teresa, is the reason this rotates every 5 years because we have five regions, or is there science involved in that?
No, it's just because of manpower and that we've got five regions. We just have the one range crew that goes around. It's so labor intensive, so they focus. There's so many transects in each region. They have to focus the entire summer in one region to get all of those read and get the data that we need. So then they'll move to the next one. We wish we could do it more often. We currently, the biologists have just been trained to do some they're not as in-depth of readings, but the guys, even the last few weeks, have been going out and doing deeper evaluations on the sagebrush condition and the different vegetative components.
Okay, let's say maybe we had a devastating fire someplace, and we felt like that needed to be reevaluated. Could we move them out of their queue or whatever they're in and have them go evaluate that?
We could have them go to maybe site-specific, not probably abandon their entire region, but maybe get a few guys down and read some transects. We actually did that last year. We pulled a few of the range trend guys down. We did read transects up on the Beaver Mountain to evaluate some areas that we were concerned with mountain goats. So if there are areas of great concern, we can get the biologist and range trend guys to go out there and focus on a couple specific areas, but it is still manpower limited.
Okay, so let's say they make vast range improvements. So can we do the same thing for improvements that we do for devastation? Nailed it, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Again, I mean, if there's a specific reason that we need to go back there sooner than 5 years, and I know you've heard us say so many times that these treatments sometimes take 5, 10 plus years to really get established and look good. So that's why we feel like the 5 years to measure improvements is probably adequate. I know that you don't want to get that Ponsagot herd back up to 6,500 more than we do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions, Teresa? Narak? Mac?
In our last RAC meeting, we had a schedule showing what the population was in each unit. How do you arrive at that population of deer in the state of Utah per unit?
Our population estimate, we use all of the data that we collect throughout the year. We'll use our fawn production, our buck-to-doe ratios, winter loss, the collar studies that we've got going on to kind of verify what winter loss we may have had, and we do modeling on that. That's You can count elk, you can count bighorn sheep. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to count deer. So we have to incorporate all our real data and put it in models.
How accurate is that?
We feel like it's the most accurate that we have. It's the best science available. No. And most Western states, I know they do some pretty intensive stuff in Arizona, but all of the states have to do modeling to some extent with mule deer because the complexities of physically counting those animals.
I spend a lot of time on the Boulder Plateau, and it seems like the last 5 years, the deer population has gone down. Last fall, we hardly seen a doe when you get a cow. So, I think the trend is down.
I think the trend is probably down west-wide with our mule deer populations.
Thanks, Mac. Other questions? Seeing none, we have questions from the public on deer. Let's move through deer. Any questions for Teresa on the presentation? I don't have any comment cards specific to deer. If I've missed somebody, let me know. It looks like these comments are for the next agenda item. Is that right? So, gentlemen, that's ours to deal with. There aren't any changes requested tonight. It's mainly the plans with the population objectives that we've seen. Discussion, motion. Rusty.
I'll make a motion to accept the I'll make a motion to accept the recommendations of the division on the deer management plan.
As presented?
As presented.
Thanks, Rusty. Second? Seconded by Dale. Any discussion on the motion? Let's take a vote. Those in favor? Any against? That looked unanimous. Next.
All right, on to elk. In March of 2010, the Wildlife Board passed the statewide elk plan. During that plan, we addressed issues such as habitat, population size, hunting, poaching, predation, disease issues, access management, depredation, CWMU or private land issues, winter feeding, and competition. After we pass our statewide plans, then we form our unit plans. Last fall, in the southern region, we formed 10 different committees, and I think all of you guys served on one of our committees. But we had committees for the Southwest Desert, the Fillmore, both subunits, the Pavant and Oak Creek, the Beaver, Monroe, Mount Dutton, the Plateau Fish Lake, Thousand Lake, the Plateau Boulder, which we combine with the Kaparowitz, Paunsagunt, Panguitch Lake, and the Zion and Pine Valley we combine together. On each of those committees, we needed the following members. I served on all of the committees. The district biologists for the units were also on the committees. Two local sportsmen served. And those were invited by the Division of Wildlife. We had representatives from the Farm Bureau, Cattlemen's Association, Wool Growers, the BLM, Forest Service, local elected official, a RAC member, someone from a CWMU association, if there are CWMUs on that unit, representatives from Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Mule Deer Foundation, and then a local landowner or landowners association representative, which was invited by either the county commission or council. these unit committees, their jobs were to review the individual herd management plans to see if the herd size objective could be revised. They had to follow all of the sideboards that were already set in place by the statewide plan, and they acted in an advisory capacity for this unit plan revision. After we got these plans done, we're now bringing them to them, to you guys, to the RAC for approval, and then to the Wildlife Board, and to get public input. These unit plans are, I hope everybody knows how important these plans are. State law, I believe it was in 94, which requires that we set population objectives and have management plans for all of our units. And state law requires that we have these plans. Once they are approved by the Wildlife Board, they become kind of our roadmap. As division employees, then we look at these plans, and our recommendations are to be consistent with the plans that are approved. So this is kind of a big deal, because then for the next 5 years, this will be what drives our recommendations. Just a quick review on the statewide elk plan, some of the objectives. The population objective in the statewide plan asks us to seek opportunities to increase population objectives in individual elk unit management plans to attain a total statewide population of 80,000 elk. Currently, we're at a little over 68,000 elk. And this is ensuring that any increases will be subject to analysis of impacts to the habitat, to the landowners, to livestock operators, and to mule deer populations. Habitat objectives in the statewide plan ask that we maintain elk habitat throughout the state by identifying and protecting existing crucial elk habitat and mitigate for losses due to human impacts, and also to improve the quality and quantity of forage and cover on 250,000 acres of elk habitat, with emphasis on calving and upper elevation winter range by the end of this plan. And that, again, is statewide, 250,000 acres throughout the entire state. Recreation objectives in the statewide plan. We'd like to continue to offer a diverse hunting program that allows for both general season opportunities and high-quality limited entry hunting opportunities. We'd also like to increase opportunities for viewing elk while educating the public concerning the needs of elk and the importance of habitat. Here is a table showing the population objective summary for the units in the southern region. The units that we will be asking for changes on, the Fillmore Pavant, we would like to increase by 175 from 1425 up to 1600. The Plateau Fish Lake, Thousand Lake, going from a population objective of 4800 up to 5600. And the Ponsagant, we actually would like to ask for a decrease in the elk population there of minus 35. But the rest of the units, we would just like to maintain at the previously approved objective. The Plateau Fish Lake, just a few notes on that unit. Between 2002 and 2011, over 38,000 acres were treated just off of the unit onto the boulder south of Highway 24 on the Parker Rim and down into Grass Valley. Over 10,000 acres were treated on winter range that elk use heavily. The majority of the committee members were in favor of the increase. On the Fillmore Pavant, the biggest concerns on that unit were we've got to continue doing habitat improvements. We've broke it into two areas, the northern and the southern portions, with focus areas in Wild Goose, Pioneer, Ebbs Canyon, and in the southern portion to do South Mountain, Dry Wash, and Dog Valley. And another big issue on with that Pavant committee, they would really like to develop and protect more water sources, protect some of those springs, maybe build fences so we don't have as much elk damage on those springs, and also spread some different water sources out so we can distribute the elk a little bit more on that unit. Other committee considerations. On the beaver unit, we would like to reduce the elk population west of I-15 in the area we call the Beaver West. On the Fillmore Provant, again, increase water development and focus on habitat projects. With the Plateau Fish Lake unit, we really would like to carefully implement the plan and use adaptive management to ensure that any increased elk that we have does not negatively impact the habitat or the landowners. On the Poncegon, we would like to focus antlerless removal on the southern portion of the unit to keep those elk from encroaching further down into the deer winter range. And in 2013, for both the Beaver West and then the Fillmore South Oak Creek, we would like to recommend that both of those units go to general season any bull units. That will have implications to our elk landowner association on the Fillmore South Oak Creek. So statewide changes, just if you're interested, across the state, the Chalk Creek is asking for an increase of 500 animals, Camas an increase of 200, Aviniquin 350 more, West Desert, not to be confused with the Southwest Desert, 150 more. The Poncegont, 35 less. The Fillmore Provant, 175 more. And the Plateau Fish Lake, 800 more. So that would be an increase of 2,140 statewide, which would probably bring us up to about 70,000. Not quite our 80,000 that the plan had asked for. That's all I've got.
Thank you. Questions from the rack? Sam?
Again. Through all of this on the elk plan, I know we're using the DCI to determine population objectives on deer. Why don't we bring DCI up in any of the elk plan, and why isn't it? Seems to me like they're going to be rougher on winter range than deer are. Is there a reason
yes.
we don't talk about
Yes,
that?
The DCI, the Desired Component Index, is really targeted on species that deer feed on more, so and the deer winter ranges. So it where we have our transects, where we read those DCI and get those DCI scores, they really are targeted towards deer winter range rather than what elk are using. And sometimes we do extrapolate that a little bit, but it really is targeted. DCI is more towards deer.
Okay, and this doesn't really pertain to elk specifically, but why is it we don't evaluate any summer range? Isn't that not important as the winter range?
No, that is very important also, and I know that people are very concerned with summer range aspen issues, riparian, willow, but it's difficult because we can't do to any accuracy summer counts.
Summer counts on the wildlife?
On elk.
Specifically on the elk?
On
oh,
elk, yeah.
Okay.
I know that years ago, I think that you probably worked with when Hal Stout was the Poncegon biologist, he had really toyed with that idea, but the complexity of sightability with elk when all the foliage is out makes it quite complicated.
Okay, but I'm not really concerned in counting elk as much as using a DCI study to determine, you know, help determine population objectives. That's just a comment. You don't
sure.
need to answer that.
Sure.
Hey, Teresa, on the Plateau Fish Lake acreage, 38,450 acres treated, what's the agency breakdown in that? Is that?
I would have to go through bit by bit. I've got the plans, or the plans are online that have all of the habitat projects listed. We could get with Vance or Jim that have made those lists. I don't have it right here with me. We can
Maybe just a guess in terms of the major player in that. Is that mostly BLM, mostly forest?
It's half and half.
Is it about half and half?
Probably half and half, Ant says.
Forty-two percent
Forest Service, 33% BLM.
And that's the percent.
That's percent of the range, also. So it's not it's not specifically on who did what habitat projects.
Is that winter range then we're talking about for both of those percentages, or is that
mostly winter?
Mostly winter, Vince says.
Mostly winter. In one of your earlier slides, you talked about ensuring that increases will be subject to an analysis of the impact to habitat, landowners, and livestock. Was there analysis done with BLM? Did some agreements come out with BLM in terms of the increase? Is BLM comfortable with analysis? Were those analyses done together?
BLM has served on both our statewide plan and on our unit plans. As far as an analysis, I don't know, Harry.
That's what I was wondering about in here, where it says the increases will be subject to an analysis of the impacts to habitat. And that's why I was wondering if anybody went out on the ground, if DWR biologists and BLM biologists went out on the ground to look at forage, amount of forage, habitat available, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's a good question. We get with the federal agencies, Forest Service, BLM, State Land, as well as some private landowners, and we do yearly spring range rides, and we go out and look at that range. We also do our other habitat monitoring, like Teresa mentioned, along with the DCI index. And so during specifically the Fish Lake Elk Committee, we did talk about range conditions, and especially the winter range and the amount that's been treated in the last decade or so, and the general consensus, I think, by everybody is that in general the winter range is in very good condition with a lot of forage still available.
I guess ultimately my real question is in terms of the number 800. That seems like a pretty big jump. I visited with some of the BLM folks, and they're feeling like maybe these improvements have not demonstrated themselves yet to be able to handle that number. I think most of our livestock men are still running at reduced numbers because of challenges in forage. And so sometimes it seems to contradict itself if you increase for wildlife, but we're asking livestock men to continue with reductions.
The BLM actually voted for the increase.
And that's going to be my next question. Who are the
I've got the notes.
I don't think so.
Let's maintain order. Let her answer the question. We'll have time for public input.
And I'm not here to target that point.
I've got the notes you can have.
And I'm coming in new behind Paul. And that was going to be my last question, was who the representative was and if he or she voted for the increase.
It was Larry Green one.
Did the notes say whether he was in agreement or not? It seems like they were there.
He did vote for the increase.
And just for my own satisfaction, maybe we can look at those notes sometime, because I'm getting some feedback that Larry wasn't in favor, but I haven't been able to talk to Larry himself.
Got him right here.
But if that's the case, then that's what the BLM will roll with. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot. That just came to mind as I was looking at your notes.
Chris Colton needs a comment card.
I didn't fill one out, but I'd like to have some input.
Please do.
Chris Colton.
Other questions while she's looking that up?
Not comment time?
No.
That's all from me for the moment.
Teresa? At our last RAC meeting, when we talked about analyst permit recommendation, you showed a population estimate post-2011 at 75,375 on elk. And you just stated it was 68 $100,000.
Say that one more time.
I said at our last RAC meeting when we discussed analyst permits, you showed population estimate post-2011, elk number 75,000.
That's the population estimate, not the total of the population objective. They're two different things.
Right.
The estimate is what we think we have.
But
the objective is
the
what we're supposed to have.
When
the
you...
objective. If I use the word estimate, I was in error. The objectives added together statewide is about 68,000. And Larry said, there's room for more elk. If the BLM was going to recommend an increase for elk, I would like this increase for livestock as well. Figures show an increase of 600 or more plus an increase for livestock depending on the season of use. We'd have to talk to our supervisors, but do not support more livestock. Also support an increase in the age class.
So he sounds like he was also looking at the livestock
sure.
question.
Steve?
Sure, Mackie, another one?
One other question or review. I was a RAC member assigned to that elk plan, and the forest ranger from Richfield, Jason Kling, was there after conversing with Curtis Robbins, his counterpart in Iowa. Jason said the fish lake could not sustain an increase population at this time.
He did vote against it.
Yes, right.
He was
now,
one of the six that voted against it.
My question is, why do you recommend an increase when the federal land manager, who knows more about the land than anybody else, recommended against the increase?
We're getting different stories from the same agency. Some members higher up in the Forest Service are giving us a different story. We feel also talking to them that we can support an increase.
Okay. Last RAC meeting, those higher ups wrote a letter. McWhorter and Alan Rowley, or Riley. Okay. They expressed concerns about aspen generation. Elk has shown to be have a negative impact, also riparian areas. And then they last statement they said, last paragraph, I'll read it. As a result of habitat concerns, the Dixie and Fish Lake National Forests support the current population numbers as identified in existing plans, which would be 4,800. And recommend the DWR make analyst recommendations that will keep populations within existing plans. So that's the higher-ups. And they want to keep the population number at 4,800. Now, my question is, why are we recommending an increase then, from the bottom up and to the top down? The Federal Land Agency says no.
I can't speak for the Forest Service. I don't know if our Forest Service representative would like to say anything.
All I would add is that the Forest Service doesn't have a letter for tonight's agenda topic. They feel that the specific input was given in those working groups. The best discussion, the specific discussion, took place there.
Yeah.
Recognize
and I was
that,
there. They
recognize that process.
It. Yeah, and they voted against the increase. So that's how it stands. Also, according to the elk plan, April 2007, said the deer herd is currently under objective, and there is some concern that more elk may reduce deer numbers further. And I don't think deer's on the increase, and yet you want to increase elk, which make it even harder for the deer to increase. They're still going downhill. So I think maybe it's more of a discussion, so
Yeah, Vance, do you want to speak about interaction with deer on?
You bet. I'll speak a little bit to that. That's always a concern, and concern with all the division biologists is the effect of elk populations on deer, and that's something that we watch as close as we can. But there hasn't been any good studies that have shown a direct correlation with elk numbers and deer numbers. I think if at any point we could see a long-term trend and we could say it's because of the elk, then I think we would see a different direction on say the Fish Lake recommendation for an increase in elk herd. But that's a good concern, Mac. And I would just like to speak of the reason, as the biologist over the Fish Lake unit, the reason that I did recommend an increase in elk is first and foremost the 38,000 acres that has been treated and been very successful on most all of that. And the forage is there, and all one has to do is take a tour around the Fish Lake unit, Grass Valley, Parker Mountain, and see that forage, and it's there. Now, what the forest brought up with aspen and riparian areas, very, very good. And that would be my main concern with elk numbers also, and that's something that we'll work closely with the Forest Service, private landowners, and BLM on that. If we have areas, big general areas that perhaps may be affected by an increase in elk, we can address elk numbers fairly easily with antlerless hunts directed at pretty large geographical areas. And so, say on the east side of the Fish Lake, more on the Wayne County side, if we find heavy use on riparian areas or winter range, we can direct the major portion of antlerless permits in that area to address that. And vice versa, if we have areas where, such as the west end of the Fish Lake, right now that has really a surplus of feed on the winter range, we can issue less tags there to allow the herd to increase on that portion of the unit. And so I think, like Teresa said, the use of adaptive management, I think if we use that and we're flexible, and we can respond to concerns with the Forest Service, with the BLM, and others.
Thanks, Vance. Other questions up front? Claire.
Yeah, Trace, I'm excited to see that we have some increase, but I have a question. That our objective is 80,000. What do we need to do to get to that 80,000?
I think we're doing everything that we can right now. Around the state, a lot of the other regions, they didn't hold as many committee meetings as we did. We formed committees on every single one of our units so we could work with all of our different constituents to see if we can. We don't want to have negative impacts on landowners or habitat, but I don't know that at this point, without additional habitat work, that we will. I don't know that we're quite ready to make it to our 80,000.
Well, I see the tens of millions that we're putting of public money into this range rehab, and I'm glad that we're at least going in the right direction.
Other questions? Brian?
Do we have a dollar amount of how much we put into range of public money that we put into? Oh, yeah, I read it. Never mind. We're good. I'll find it. You're right. I've never seen it.
I thought you were calling attention to
and
that.
And we've got Byron over there that is the best at quoting dollar amounts.
Byron will likely speak to that. Other questions from the rack for Teresa? Questions from the public. If you could hold these to questions, come to the mic and give us your name, please, sir.
I'm Gary Allen. Teresa, I want to know what gives you the right to increase elk why you don't have to live with the forest plan. I don't know anything about the Dixie National Forest, but I do know about the Fish Lake. How can you go above that without your approval? That's my question.
you know, elk are always controversial, and that's why we have diverse committees, and why we spend days talking about the issues. And the federal agencies play a huge role in that, and so they're invited to the table, and we respect their opinions, and so, and that is why in the management plan it spells out you know, where the Forest Service and the other federal agencies and state agencies come their opinions on the elk numbers, and so we don't want to appear to go against, you know, Forest Service recommendations, but we still have to make recommendations on what we feel is the right thing, and so it comes down to the RAC and the board process to make that final decision.
Thanks, Vance. Other questions from the public? I've got a number of comment cards, and I'm just going to take them in order that we got them tonight. John Keeler, followed by Stan Gleave. Three minutes for individuals and 5 minutes for groups, please. We got a number of cards here.
John Keeler, Utah Farm Bureau. As I stated at the last RAC meeting, there are some big concerns that we have in the landowner livestock community as it relates to these collaborative groups and working groups that have been put together to look at the resource concerns, specifically aspen, lack of aspen regeneration, and riparian degradation. A lot of environmental groups are forcing the Forest Service into a corner, and the Forest Service has to respond because these environmental groups point out some of the parts of their forest plan that are lacking, and they hit on them hard, and these are two areas that they stress that aren't being managed properly by the Forest Service. Also, when the Forest Service looks at livestock use, this always comes into question. Aspen, lack of aspen regeneration, they're blaming the livestock as well as the elk, but they can control the livestock, and they don't seem to say that they can control the elk. So this is the process by which we make an attempt to try to control the elk. It really bothers me to see, I don't know if it's a lack of understanding or what, but we try to make the attempt to bring this to the attention of groups like this and others, that there are these resource concerns going on out there, and yet, you know, at some point it gets thwarted by a political maneuver. These are serious concerns we have out there. And we know what's happening in other states where the resource concern isn't taken care of. The environmental groups will force or try to force the wolves on it to try to take care of the problem. They're serious about these degradation problems that are existing with the aspen and the riparian areas. It's a problem. Cattle like to go to these areas. The elk love to go to these areas, and the elk are there first, and they just whittle them down to nothing. So that's a huge, huge problem, the resource concern. The trends is a concern. And even though the elk and the deer aren't the same, some of those components are the same, and the trend isn't improving. The deer herd is down, and at the meetings last fall, where we talked, the RAC discussed the mule deer management plan. Hunter after hunter after hunter stood up and anecdotally said they think elk is part of the problem. We also have a potential of dry conditions coming up. The snowpack was not good, and it looks like that could be an additional pressure on the range. The analysis that is called for as it relates to landowners and livestock, that analysis is pretty shy, I think, if these environmental groups pushed pretty hard on the monitoring that was going on or not going on, it would be a problem. As far as the antlerless that was mentioned as a tool by Vance, that tool was taken away from us. We tried to give an opportunity for the fish lake to have some analysts taken. That's not there, so you can't manage if there's nothing there to use. We just think it's ill-advised to go ahead with this 800 increase on the fish lake based on those concerns that I've mentioned. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Stan and Gleave, followed by Bill Christensen.
Hello, I'm Stanton Gleave. I'm a rancher down in Paiute County. I'm here representing the Monroe Mountain Ranchers Association. I'm president of it. I'm a board member on the Henry Mountain Grazing Association. And in all of our meetings, we discuss this about the same thing. But first of all, I want to start out, I've lived my life pretty well on that Mount Dutton and the Monroe Mountain. And there's not 2,700 deer south by 80, but it says 2,700 deer on that Mount Dutton, but there wouldn't be 500 deer. I don't think there's 300 deer on Mount Dutton. And there's not that many on the Monroe. I don't think there's 200 on the whole Monroe Mountain. It's a shame what's happened to that deer herd. And you state right here that if the elk was affecting the deer herd, you're willing to reduce the number of those elk. But the animal that's affecting the deer herd is a cougar. He eats deer and he eats them every day, and he'll eat the last one. I don't know if you'd take care of the cougars, all the rest of this stuff would solve itself, the cougars and the coyotes. You'd bring your deer herd back and you wouldn't need that thousands of elk running all over us. I don't know how long we've got to protect cougars. Those cougars are a lot like me. I'd rather eat them deer than anything else. One thing I'd quit eating deer for is a fat lamb, and they eat plenty of them. And I don't know why that's so hard to get through people's head, but it's just as plain as the nose on my face. You can't raise cougars and deer. It just won't work. But the big reason I'm here tonight is those ranches all around the Monroe Mountain is affected by that elk herd. And in every meeting we have, the question comes up, how did that elk herd go from no elk to thousands of elk? That grass that's on those mountains has been with those ranches for ever since the 1800s, and we depend on that grass. Without that grass, we don't make a living there. When those elk go up on there, we go there and the elk's already ahead of us. It'll work on these years like you've had. You've had two wet years here, and there's feed there. But you let a drought come in the country, and we're off the mountain. The Forest Service can't control those elk, but they can control us. Well, and if there's no feed, we got to come off the mountain. But anyway, that's the main thing I'm wanting to state, is this elk herd, you've got more of them than you can manage now. And then you get into this where you've treated so many thousand acres, and you think you need an increase. Well, the ranchers have been treating acres for as long as I've been around. And in my case, in 2001, that Mount Dutton burned the whole thing, and it created more grass than you've ever seen and feed on there. I didn't get one sheep. They didn't increase me one sheep. I stayed off for 2 years, that herd of sheep, both them herds of sheep, for 2 years to let the rains come back. And what did we get? We just held right to our same numbers. Well, that herd of elk is clear up, I'd say, 5,000 head at least on Mount Dutton. Wintering on Mount Dutton. Anyway, you're saying you need an increase because you've treated some acres. Well, ranches has been on the decrease for 50 years. It's like the old guy at the Wool Growers Association said. He said, we've compromised here for 50 years. He said, we've compromised from over 50 million sheep to less than 5 million. And I don't know how far you people expect ranchers to keep compromising. But we're not against wildlife. In fact, you can ask any one of these guys, there's nothing better than a good herd of deer. We want our kids to have something to hunt, like we did when we was kids. What's wrong with a big herd of deer? Nothing. And if you control the predators, they don't live in the fields. They go on the mountain. And they stay on the, well, they come down in the spring, but they'll follow the grass right back up the mountain. The reason we got in trouble with them today is there's so many predators, they got to come sleep under the bedroom window with their dogs to keep the cougars and coyotes off of them. And I don't know why we have, why these discussions, you can go around, but that's just fact. There's nothing, I ain't telling you nothing that's not just exactly fact. And if you want to solve the problem, you'll go and you'll take care of that herd of cougars, and you won't go take care of one or two. You'll go take care of them, try to wipe them out so your deer herd comes back, and then you can raise a cougar or two when you get a herd of deer back. But I guess I'm tired of feeding my herd of sheep to cougars. Every year I feed 400 to 500 lambs to cougars. And that is BS. And you say, well, you can get paid for it. You can't go out and track down cougars that's packing off them little lambs one after another. And the cougar covers up everything it packs off, everything it kills. So you can go right out there where they're killing deer and you don't know they're killing them. But anyway, that's what my main point is that there's no more increase on them elk until you figure out some way to manage what you've got there.
Thank you. Bill. Followed by Craig Conder.
And you do this very slow. I don't have enough for everybody. Just to share them and pass them down.
We got to take that course on the
home. Hi, gentlemen. My name is Bill Christensen. I'm the regional director for the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And before that, I was field director. I've been doing this for 21 years in Utah. And before that, I was involved in other wildlife issues. I come from my family still involved in the ranching business on both sides of my family. And I'm happy to be here today. I also served on the state elk advisory committee that helped come up with these plans, as John did and others in this room, Byron, others. I was involved with that and enjoyed that process immensely. Since 1987, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has impacted almost 1 million acres in this state. And since 87, we're well over 200,000 acres on the Fish Lake. In that magazine I put up there, there's only 4 copies, I apologize, but we talk about that almost 1 million of those 6 million acres has happened right here in Utah. And we've invested a lot of money in the Fish Lake, just like everyone here has, all the interests. Livestock people. We work in conjunction with a lot of our partners like Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, the Mule Deer Foundation, and other groups, including landowners and livestock operators. This investment is of money and time is as valuable as anyone else's investment. Everyone has made an investment on this mountain. And we very carefully, on the State Elk Advisory Committee, looked at every unit and realize the first thing that needs to happen is that these decisions need to be made locally. You can't have a decision top down from the state of Utah. Each one of these elk units need to be staffed by people from local areas representing livestock, politics, sportsmen, and every group. It's the only fair way to do it. On the federal public land, we are instructed to use multiple use and we need to share it. And one thing that sportsmen have done very clearly is we have put our money where our mouth is. And that's important. And I'm here representing hundreds of families here in the Sevier Valley and 8,000 Utah families. And I'm joining with the other conservation, sportsmen hunting conservation groups that have done so much. And we're saying this is one unit that has the feed and the opportunity to increase. And we do support an increase to 5,600 animals. If anybody would like a list, specific list of projects that the Elk Foundation has done, it's not quite up to speed. We're missing part of 2011, and we just did our groups got together recently and just funded a lot more projects, including many on the Fish Lake. And if you'd like to have a list of that, I'm going to give you my email address and my phone number, and I'll ask you to please call me, and I will send you a list of those projects as far as we have them. Like I said, they're not quite up to speed through 2011, but they're accurate through 2010. My email address is bchristensen, C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-S-E-N, at rmef.org, which stands for Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. My office number is 801-930-5388. I can provide specific information on funding, who gave what, when, and where, and I'd be happy to do it for anybody. And I'm sure that my partners in conservation, our hunting groups, can tell you about the money that they've invested. It's not just public money, folks. It's private money. Just like livestock operators who invested time and money over the years, so have we. I've been doing this wildlife business since the early 80s. I certainly like agriculture. I'm a supporter of it. We run a summer sheep operation in Chalk Creek. We worked with Wes and Welby Agard for years and years, and Kim Agard. We now have a new operator that we're working with. And we have some property in Wasatch County that my cousin manages the cattle operation on, a summer cow-calf operation. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Again, I'm representing the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Craig, followed by Byron Bateman. Apologize for the obstacle course up front.
Hi, my name is Craig Conder, and I just represent, I guess, a local sportsman and a wildlife and outdoor enthusiast. I just want to comment about the Fish Lake Elk situation. Growing up around here and being on the mountain quite a bit, especially over on the Salina Creek side and Salina Canyon and the Gooseberry area, used to be a lot of elk, and it was, you know, fun to go out and take photographs and be able to see those, and you just haven't been able to see those as much as they have in the past. Part of the reason is with the antlerless hunts that's occurred the past 8 years, they've all just about decimated that, you know, that first three hunts, they took it down slow. And it's interesting where they get their counts. They're going clear out on the Parker, which has a lot of the elk that are wintering from the Boulder, the Dutton, Fish Lake. They go clear out there to Pollywog and that. But when they take those counts, then they say they're all belong to Fish Lake, and then they come back in there and they do a lot of antlerless hunts there. But you just don't see the elk, and you haven't seen the elk for quite a few years across that whole Fish Lake unit that they used to have. And so were their numbers, I think their numbers are way down to begin with. And that's just spending time on the mountain. You just don't see them. As far as the increase, I would like to see more elk. I like to see elk. I like to see wildlife. But also, if we look at it, and I attended the meetings also on the habitat. I was in one of the groups, and the majority of the group agreed that increase was able to handle that on the Fish Lake. I think that we need to be careful what we do with the antlerless permits, though, especially on the Fish Lake. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Byron. Followed by Paul Niemeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Byron Bateman. I'm the president of Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. It's a pleasure to come down and address the Southern Region RAC. This is a very emotional issue, but it's an issue that we need to talk about and discuss. Both sides have great concerns. Livestock has a great concern. Sportsmen have a great concern. We're all concerned about the resource, the mountain, how much habitat's out there, how much forage is out there for deer, how much forage is out there for elk. Sportsmen have invested a lot of money in the state of Utah, along with other partners. It's close to $80 million. It's close to 800,000 acres that have been rehabilitated in the last 8 years. As Bill said, we all got together back the first part of April and committed several million dollars again to more projects throughout the state, a lot of projects to go back on the Fish Lake area, the Monroe area and all the areas here in the south. The southern region has had more habitat work done than any other region in the state. Your biologists down here are more aggressive than anywhere else in the whole state, and they go out and get more work done. We're willing to commit to doing more habitat work to maintain this increase of 800 more elk, to go from 4,800, the current plan, to go to the 5,600. As Vance said, we have the tools in the toolbox to reduce the population very fast if we need to. If something happens to that forage, we have that tool. We can be prescriptive. We can go on the east side of the mountain, west side of the mountain, north, south. We can get in there and do that. We can do that on any of these units. But I've got, for people who don't believe me, I'm a fifth-generation Utahn. My ancestors came here. They walked here, pushed hand carts here. They're in the ranching, sheep and cattle business. I used to raise a little alfalfa. I used to have some registered Herefords and stuff like that. I've got my brand inspection card in my wallet. I keep it with me all the time. Still got horses and mules. But it's, as Bill alluded to, the Forest Service is multiple use. When one of us goes away, the other group's going to have to burden the whole fight. You talk about the antis. Their big thing now is aspen and willow regeneration. You saw what they did to Yellowstone Park with the same story, introduced wolves. What happened to the wildlife? It's gone. What happened to the cattle industry up there? It's cost them hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars in lost revenue. We need to work together as partners, livestock owners and sportsmen. We're willing to work together, and we've got a proven track record of what we've done and what we can do throughout the state. If we can identify more projects, we need to make sure that we don't overutilize the range, that nobody loses, because I want to see a win-win situation for us. I don't want anybody from Washington, D.C. to come out here and tell us how we should manage our public lands, Forest Service, BLM, which are public lands. It should be the people here in Utah. It should be the people here in the local communities that were part of these committees and stuff like that. And the local committee came up with, you know, through a lot of hard questions and information that was discussed in those committee meetings, the consensus, it wasn't a consensus, but it was a majority said, we can stand an increase on the Fish Lake. We can go from 4,800 to 5,600 elk. One other point for Mr. Gleave, and I really appreciate his comments. We just got $1.3 million passed through the legislature for coyote control. The governor signed the bills on March 17th for that $1.3 million. The Mule Deer Restoration Act. There's nothing we want more than to have our mule deer herds back and sportsmen for fish and wildlife. We're committed to take out all the stops with that money going back into bounty and aerial gunning to bring our deer herds back. We're putting up a lot of our own money to do a mule deer transplant off of the Parowan front to different areas to try and move some of those mule deer that are in trouble, put them where they can be utilized somewhere else. So sportsmen are committed. We're committed to work with our partners, the ranching industry, the cattle industry, the sheep industry, the Farm Bureau. We just need to work together as partners and, you know, get these differences, you know, aside. 800 elk is not really a big number if you look at it in the overall picture. So I just ask for your support. Let's work together. Let's go along with the division's recommendation. But let's hold them accountable, too, to make sure that if there is a problem, that we can come back in and address that problem like they said they can do. And I know they can do it. Thank you.
Thanks, Byron. Paul. Followed by Jeremy Chamberlain.
I'm Paul Emer, representing the local SFW chapter. As most of you guys know, in Wayne and Paiute and Sevier County on our chapter banquet a year ago, we donated quite a bit of money to these counties for coyote control to help them pay the bounties that are these coyote people get. But I want to give you a little history on the Fish Lake. Back in 1994 is when we did the first elk management plans. And I was involved in that at that time. There was recommendations on that everywhere from 3,500 to 7,500 elk. It was finally, that was back before the RAC and the board process. You had the Board of Big Game Control that dealt with any big game issues, and then you had the Wildlife Board. There were two separate boards that dealt with everything else. But anyway, through all that hassle and gyration around, they finally settled at 5,000 on the Fish Lake. Then they went into a deal a year or two later, and they decided to make these boundaries on these units major highways or rivers or whatever. The old Fish Lake boundary went north of I-70 up to the Manti Fish Lake Forest boundary. But the plan was for 5,000, what they finally settled on, and then they when they changed that boundary, they carved it back to 4,800. And so that's where from virtually 94 on, we've been at 4,800. And that's kind of how that got there. But since then, you know, just on the Fish Lake, we've done, you know, even in recent years, probably over 50,000 acres on the Fish Lake of range rehab. And you can see it. I mean, you've got to kind of count that on the Parker Rim as part of Fish Lake, because that's where a lot of the Fish Lake elk winter, and they also count those as Fish Lake elk when they fly. So, but that's what we've done. It's ongoing. When we did meet this year in these elk management plans, I was on a couple of plans, and we did on the Fish Lake originally talk about 6,500. That was the DWR recommendation. And then when everything kind of got deliberated down, the DWR is asking for 5,600, which is a split between 48 and 6,500. And in the management plan, that was a majority vote to accept that management plan. So we're asking you guys to support the DWR recommendation on these elk units. Those came with a lot of thought and study, and we are doing ongoing habitat projects constantly to try and improve habitat, and that is our recommendation, to go to the 5,600 in the Fish Lake and also support the other elk management plans in this region. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Jeremy, followed by Wade Heaton.
I'm Jeremy Chamberlain from the Friends of the Ponsagunt, and I just want to first of all tell the RAC thank you for your time. Our little group, the little Friends of the Ponsagunt group, that we pay attention to what's going on down there on the Ponsagunt, and we meet, we try to monthly, and so we appreciate the time that you guys spend in our behalf listening to us and listening to the recommendations. We also meet with the Fish and Game on a pretty regular basis, and right now Dustin and a few of us, Dustin's a biologist down there on the Ponsagunt, and not that he doesn't do a good job, but really with Sam and Rusty and us as concerned sportsmen, we keep pretty good track of what he does, and he does a great job. I will say that he does a phenomenal job of making recommendations, keeping us in the know, I guess, of what the Fish and Game and the DWR are trying to do. I would like to say, you know, there's been a lot of public comment tonight about the Fish and Game doing this and the Fish and Game not doing that, and they need to do this and they need to do that. Our little group gets together with the Fish and Game, and it's actually become a really nice working relationship with them. There's no hidden punches or anything like that that we pull on them or they pull on us. And we've been really pleased with the way that the Ponsagunt is turning around, and it's not back to where we would like it as sportsmen or anything like that, but we're working towards it. And we feel as a group that the Fish and Game are behind us. We're behind them and making great strides, especially with this elk management plan. Maybe it's because we're getting rid of 35 more of them. But anyway, I appreciate your guys' time, and thank you.
Thank you. Wade, followed by Rich Persons.
Wade Eaton, represent the Alton CWMU.
Just very briefly. I was on the Elk, Pontiac Elk, committee. DWR did a great job. They truly did. We had a really diverse group on our committee. They had a lot of good ideas. They really went out of their way to, just to pool everybody, you know, to find out, where everybody wanted to go. And then they really did a good job staying with that direction. And in our case, the majority of the people wanted to decrease permits, which is their recommendation. Anyway, just hats off to them. They did a good job. They've got a very difficult assignment, especially some of the other units with Pontiac. It's not that bad. We hate them, and so we want them dead. But with a lot of these others, it's far more difficult. Anyway, CWMU and as a member of the Friends of the Pontiac, we do support the DWR's recommendation for their elk management plan. Thanks.
Thank you. Rich. Followed by Gary Allen.
Just would like to express appreciation to the RAP committee, to the Department of Wildlife Resources. I am in favor of the increase. And so that you know that I'm coming from a understanding both sides of the equation. My family is directly involved in cattle ranching, has significant interest in having access to public lands for that. And on the other hand, I work for the Forest Service. I'm the budget officer. I see a lot of things that are happening there and where the money's going. I cannot speak for them or for my relatives and family that are involved in the cattle business. I'm speaking as an individual. As an individual sportsman, I believe what the Department of Wildlife Resources has done with their studies and their analysis support the increase on the fish lake, and so I recommend or ask you to approve that.
Thank you. Gary Allen, followed by Troy Justison.
I just want to say on record that the 38,000 acres that you guys you're all taking credit for that. Half of that should have went to livestock. Livestock should have had a 50% increase before you guys get any increase. That's the way it's set up. There's been no permit. He's got any more. No permits. And I'm telling you, I don't want you to raise your elk numbers. I don't want to have to, instead of feeding 400 of them, I don't want to have to feed 800. Because he has the tools to manage that, but he can't manage one little bunch of elk. But Trish, I want to thank you for one thing, because you do know how to manage elk. You give me permission to shoot them. And that's the best management tool that you guys have got. And you should applaud her and listen to what she's saying. Decrease your number.
Troy. Followed by Vernon King.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman, Fish and Wildlife. I believe at the last board meeting, Director Karpowitz stated that there's been a total of $16 million and over 220,000 acres treated right in this general vicinity. Byron pretty much spoke exactly what I wanted to talk about. We as a sportsman have invested a lot of dollars in this place. We know that we have to have a good working relationship with the cattlemen. We're not here to drive them out of business. I think we've proved in the past, such as what's happened on the Henrys with the bison, that we are able to reach across the aisle, work together, do projects that benefit both wildlife and livestock. We support and like to support the division's recommendation to increase the numbers on the fish lake by 800. Thank you.
Thank you. Verlin, followed by Chris Colton.
Verlin King, I'm a private landowner in Paiute County.
I think you need to pay attention to what Gary Allen said and what was discussed by the board about what the federal agencies said, that they didn't want to increase unless they increased the livestock. It, you know, there's been a lot of talk about all these acres that have been worked up, and that's great, but we found out on the, and I'm a member of the Henry Mountain Bison Committee, that a lot of, you can do a lot of work on the ground, but the bison or the elk a lot of times can't utilize it because it's based on water. A lot of this stuff you're talking about that's done is great. I'd like to see those elk stay up there right around Highway 24, but they're not. They're coming down lower. And this year wasn't the snow that pushed them lower. I've got private land right in the bottom. Those elk have to water in Otter Creek, and they graze my pasture coming and going. And if you increase the herd, increase the numbers on the fish lake, that's going to increase the numbers that I'm going to be feeding. I talked to my neighbor a little while ago, and he says, boy, you got a lot of deer out on that receding. Three years ago, I got some money from the GIP, and I reseeded some sagebrush. And he says, you've got a big herd of deer out there. And I thought, well, that's great, but I like the deer. I don't mind feeding them. I've got 100 head in my field over in Wayne County. But you need to listen to Stanton Gleave when he talks about the lion. That's what's killing the deer, them and the coyotes. And you guys can say coyote, but we need to control the lion too. You need to control the predator if you're gonna get a deer herd. You know, we've done these studies. The DWR has this 5-year range trend, and then you quiz them down. You corner them, and they tell you, oh, it just studies deer habitat. Well, the elk and the deer have the same habitat in the winter, and it's winter rains that's critical. And if I mean, no matter how much you go and improve, and it helps, but a lot of times it's based on the water, a lot of times it's based on other factors that the wildlife that you can't control. So I think I would recommend that the RAC board not accept this 800 elk increase on the fish lake. This is a good deal about, you know, we talked about we can control them, we can do this, we can have hunts, but that, in my experience, that doesn't work. You might can kill a few, you end up moving them somewhere else, and then somebody else has a problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Verlin. Sure, Sam. Verlin. Question for you.
Yeah, Verlin. Are you receiving any compensation for these elk grazing in your fields that you're referring to?
No, I'm not.
Is there a reason that he's not? If you have a depredation problem with elk, my understanding is DWR can analyze, evaluate that, and you can receive money for that depredation.
Yeah, I'm not asking, haven't approached them that way. On my ranch in Wayne County, the problem that I do have are big bulls, and that doesn't fit in the depredation problem. But and also, I can get depredation doe tags. But the last 2 years, I've elected not to because I want the herd to increase there. So.
Well, it's appreciated that you feel that way, but if you strongly feel you're being hurt, you're authorized to get that depredation, and you should take advantage of that program. And that would allow for the increase in the elk, and we could all come to terms with that.
Well, that's good in theory, but my experience isn't that it works that good. To get the depredation tags, to get the control that needs to be there when it needs to be there.
Okay, but it's not necessarily tags. They can actually pay you for the damage after it's assessed in real dollars.
Okay, well, that's the hard part, is figuring out what the damage is. So
they have a formula to do that, and you should take advantage of it if you're getting hurt.
Okay, well, right now I don't feel I'm getting hurt that much, but I don't need another 800 head to work with.
If they do the increase, then maybe you should change your mind on that.
Well, I will if they do the increase, and if we can, I mean, if we can document it, that's the problem. I'm there a couple of days a week. All I see are the tracks. But what I'm saying is they have to water in Otter Creek. And to get to Otter Creek, they damage private land all the way up and down the creek.
Who's your biologist for DWR in that area?
I don't know.
Can you comment on this?
Sam, let's not call the division out on a depredation problem that,
okay,
that really resides with the landowner.
I take that back. I just,
if he wants to initiate that process, let's let him do that. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Thanks, Ferlin. I think you made your point. We appreciate it. Chris Colton.
Thank you. Chris Colton. I'm the assistant field manager for renewable resources for the BLM in Richfield. Most of the country around the Fish Lake unit is ours. I didn't come tonight prepared to speak, but I think you guys need to understand something about the BLM, and I need to clear up some misunderstanding that maybe happened in the elk committees. BLM was formed actually the grazing service was formed in 1934 at the passage of the Taylor Grazing Act to stabilize the grazing industry. Cowboys were killing the sheepmen were killing the cowboys. They formed the BLM, assigned base property to the local people, and that's the way grazing's allocated on the BLM. Forest Service is a similar system. They're older. As a bureaucrat, and 62% of people hate the government, by the way, in a poll I read last week, but that's our lot. But I have to live with laws and I have to live with regulations. Let me tell you a little bit of history about the, especially Grass Valley, which turns out to be a lot of the winter range for the Fish Lake area. Early 1990, the State Division of Water Quality put Otter Creek on the Clean Water Act 303D list, meaning it is not in compliance with clean water standards for the state of Utah. That means that with the water quality that's there, it does not meet the purpose that it was allocated for. It's not clean enough. There was a watershed assessment performed on Grass Valley. BLM was blamed with part of that water quality problem. In response, we initiated a lot of the treatment that went on with there in 303D, Section 319 funded a lot of the initial treatments in Grass Valley. And before the Utah Partners for Conservation Development, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, the Mule Deer Foundation were all contacted. They participated in doing those improvements in there. Well, the reason that part of that was on the Clean Water Act problem was because that range was in poor, stinking condition. The sheepmen, most of it was sheep allotments, and the sheepmen couldn't even use it anymore. Too damn many coyotes. The forage was poor. They couldn't make a profit running there. Okay, introduce all this treatment. Okay, BLM, in part of our regulatory authority, we have to have functional uplands, which is where most of these treatments are. We have to have functional riparian areas, which is included, dispersed throughout this area. We have to take into account water quality, and lastly, we have to provide for endangered species, because the Endangered Species Act trumps all of this stuff. And in the background's all that stabilizing the industry. I'm sorry, can I have another few minutes?
Yeah, you got a couple more minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. Point being, yes, there's been a lot of improvement, a lot more than 38,000 acres since I've been in Richfield for 20 years. I think we've done pushing 60,000 acres, and yes, it looks good, and yes, maybe if we put more elk on it, they'd do just fine. But number one, the regulations for grazing say if there is increased forage, Any cuts that have occurred to people, and these guys have referred to them, in the 60s through the early 90s, up to 50% of some of these permits were suspended almost on a permanent basis because the feed wasn't there. I'm telling you, it was poor. And before we can give anything to wildlife, we've got to reallocate the first feed to that. Okay? Then, on a prorated basis, we can take care of any other forage that's there. Well, maybe wildlife's part of that, maybe it isn't. The reason I brought up the Clean Water Act stuff is Otter Creek still does not meet those water quality standards, and we do not need more grazing, more elk, more deer, more sheep, more cows. We don't need it, and we need to stabilize that. In 2002, when the Fish and Game let out all those antlerless permits on the Fish Lake, it was just by happenstance that elk herd was reduced going into the worst drought we've had in a century, and the cowboys still took 80 to 100% cuts on their allotments, and that isn't what I'd call stabilizing the livestock industry. And so increasing anything is not in the cards, besides being almost impossible. Now down to the Endangered Species Act, we're looking at a sage hen listing in 2015 possibly, and right now there's a lot of things being bandied about that there could be a lot of adverse actions on these permittees right now regardless of what happens just due to the sage hens, and I'm telling you right now that there just does not need to be any more grazing, and we need to take care of what we got and do that. Anyway, any questions for me?
Thanks, Chris. David Brinkerhoff, followed by Glenn Allen.
David Brinkerhoff. I'm a grazer on 7 Mile allotment, and also with some of the country that Chris just talked about on the BLM. I'm a Henry Mountain Grazers. I serve on both of those boards at this point. I spend a lot of time on the range, and we don't need any more elk on the range at this time. My main concern is the resource. There's a lot of damage that occurs on those early springtime when it greens up, if you've got a herd of elk taking it as quick as it comes, and that's what they do. The elk are right there as quick as the first blade of green starts, and they follow it right up the hill. I'm quite concerned about that part of it, and I'm also concerned about the watershed. As we all know, that the Quaking Asp or the Aspen does a lot to bring our watershed and the things that we need to just sustain life. If we follow what a lot of these environmental groups are concerned about it, they put a lot of blame on the livestock. There was one individual that put a camera out, and what's taking those aspen are the elk. Resource is important. Once you devastate that resource, it's not going to come back for years. We have to remember those things. The habitat is very important. The local grazing managers have recommended that we don't increase elk. They're at the bottom. They see the problem. They see what's going on. And yet we have to take our orders from the top down. That doesn't have the understanding of what's going on the bottom end, on the land. Lately, maybe the last 10 years, we're starting to see a lot of elk coming into the ranchers' farms. There's not a lot of winter wheat or stuff growing in Wayne County, but a lot of these countries like Paiute and stuff, they do some winter grazing or winter wheat growing, and the elk are down on there taking at it or doing the damage as quick as it starts to come up. So we need to if we look at increasing more elk, we're just going to increase more damage. Currently, I'm holding 3,000 plus suspended AUMs that I can't use right now. If we're going to increase elk, we need to increase livestock too. I appreciate what the habitat that's been improved, but I think we need to understand that that habitat that's improved is also something that they need to maintain also. That's a maintenance operation. The livestock people go through that every year, maintaining the resource that they already have. And that's what a lot of those resources that are reseedings and stuff has done, is they've improved the resource and it looks great. But we need to understand we need to maintain those things. I thank you guys for your time and effort that you put in to serve on those boards. And I thank you.
Thank you. Glenn? Followed by Scott Christensen.
I'm Glenn Allen. I'm a rancher. I'm up here for myself. What I want to say is I'm absolutely against an increase. I've bought and paid for what I've got. What I have was not given to me. I pay a grazing fee every month on the animals I run. This is nothing free. We want to talk numbers. Add up the dollars that the farmer and rancher puts in for grazing fees alone. Do the math on that. The other thing is the depredation program that they mentioned. Pennies on the dollar. If I come in your house, steal your TV, I'm going to give you $20 for it when I leave, because that's about what the trade-off is. The last thing I want to say here is all an increase is going to do, it's going to start a range war. You're going to drive a bigger wedge between the rancher and the sportsman. And that's all that's going to happen. And for this comment, for the sportsman, if you're going to threaten me, and you're going to threaten my family, go ahead and sign your name. That's all I'm asking. Sign your name. Thank you.
Scott, followed by DeLoss. DeLoss is the last card I have. If I've missed anybody, any other cards?
Scott Christensen. I live in Loa. I just wanted to make a few points. I sat on the elk committee that was the same committee that Max sat on. I guess I kind of walked away with a little bit of a different view, and I wanted to share kind of my outlook of the meeting. I just represented a sportsman or myself in that committee. When it came to the vote and we talked about many different things, the notes that I had was Jason Kling was the Forest Service representative. He was standing in for Kurt Robbins that could not make it, apparently, to the meeting. Also, there was Greg Rasmussen, who represented the Forest Service for the elk, and Larry Greenwood, who represented the BLM. Craig and Larry both felt like there was feed not being consumed and going to waste on the range. So both of them, if you look at the minutes, recommended that the increase be made. Like it was stated before, sportsmen, SFW asked for 6,500 head, but through the committee and talking about protecting the resource, not wanting to extend it too high at once, then it was voted on to just increase it to the 5,600 that's been recommended to the RAC. I guess I was kind of, I really learned a lot in the meeting. I didn't feel like when they shot all the cows, I think they said in 2002 was by accident. I thought that was somewhat planned for concerning droughts that already were happening. I don't believe it was by accident, by any means. I know there's been a lot of discussion. I'm a big mule deer fan. Those that know me, I'd kill every elk in the state if I really believed it would get our mule deer herds back. That's my passion. But if, as we've studied and I've talked with many of the biologists, we've reduced deer number or elk numbers completely on several units or tried to, and we're still not seeing that increase of the deer on those units. It's a mystery. I know there's a lot of people working on it. Nobody wants it back more than me. But until we can really see some true evidence on some of these areas where we have, like the Henrys try to take every elk off the mountain and really see an explosion of deer, even that unit's declining on population. So just back to the, I also had another question, and maybe some of the grazers can ask. I support 100% if we're going to increase the elk population, that we do increase grazing permits that have been cut. As far as I know, and it's more of a question, are sportsmen ever invited to those decisions with the Forest Service and BLM to support you guys and to help out with that? Okay, because I do agree. If we're going to increase the elk herds, I think some of the cattlemen have every right to request. I guess I feel like we're asking the wrong committee. Nobody on this board, unless they serve a different role, has the ability to increase grazing permits. If I can be of any help, I would be more than happy to come support increased grazing rights.
Time, Scott. You want to wrap up?
Yep. Just to wrap up, I do support the increase of 5,600.
Thank you. The laws. Three minutes, sir.
Without being sarcastic or rhetorical, my heroes have always been cowboys. Way before Willie Nelson ever thought of that lyric. My grandfather ran horses on 29 sections. My father farmed all his life. I rode bareback and chased 1,000 head of horses more miles than I ever want to count before I was old enough to ride in a saddle. I understand what these gentlemen's heartaches are. It's hard to make a living farming. However, I like hunting. It's a lifestyle too. We have a right to share those ranges under the multiple use program. That's the law. We had over 7,000 elk on the fish lake at one time. The only problems that were identified in those years were early elk feeding in the new planted fields in Gooseberry. However, the RACs, the division, and the cattle association asked us to remove those elk and to help restore the habitat on that mountain. And then all of the groups involved, including the Farm Bureau, said when that restoration is done, we'll put some elk back on that unit if you'll agree to reduce them while we regrow the grass. We did that. The projects that were used to put the forage that's out there now that motivated Mr. Rasmussen and Mr. Greenwood to support increasing the numbers came from the seed money that the sportsmen gave the federal government to match those restoration projects. Now, during that meeting, Max is right. They identified new problems because the old ones were gone. They told us that. Everyone that was there knows that they told us those winter ranges didn't need more work. But the riparian areas and the aspen groves did. Now, here's the problem. If we supported the restoration of the BLM and the winter range, and there's no payback for that, are we going to be motivated to provide that seed money to help with the restoration of those aspen groves that are so critical for both parties? How can we do that if we don't keep the agreement we had in the 90s? As some of the folks have said this evening, we came to that meeting that the DWR invited us to asking for 1,500 head back to where we were. We compromised already nearly 50%. I don't want any of these folks to go broke because of elk. In fact, Max, you remember how long we spoke with Gary Howells about whether or not we've gone over, so I'll take just another minute. We talked about how we could help you, didn't we, in that meeting. And what we said was, maybe you can come on early and stay late during the good years. Didn't we say that? Look at your minutes. It's right there. That was our recommendation to help livestock. I've been in these meetings for 37 years. I have never recommended that we reduce a single sheep or a single cow from a unit. Never. Never have I heard another sportsman do that. We have always wanted to work with our families and friends in that industry. I didn't hear many Fish Lake grazers here tonight. I heard a general discussion against elk. Where are the people? Where's my neighbor, Mr. Ripstein, who runs cows on the Fish Lake tonight? He's not here. The people here tonight aren't saying there isn't room on the Fish Lake. They're saying there's no room. I support the division's recommendations. Appreciate. Thanks.
Thanks, Klaus.
To recap, not to diminish the comments here tonight, in terms of those in favor and those against, it's a pretty even split. I think that plateau seems to have been mentioned the most, and so with that in mind, let me back up. One more comment card, Scott Allen. Looks like you get the last word.
I'm Scott Allen, and I'm here for myself. I'm a rancher, and as far as I go, they've got up here and they're putting landowners' backs against the wall. If you add more elk, you're just putting their backs against the wall. We got no rights on our own private land. As far as depredation goes, it is just a slap in the face. The damage that is occurred does not get paid for. It don't get compensated for. And as far as all this money has been put into the ranges around here, as far as I go, I don't keep a total. That's my livelihood. I can't get up here and give the numbers of what me and my family and what everybody has done to improve the range. I ain't going to brag about that. But yet, we're just going to keep pushing the livestock around and putting us down. I don't know. I'd like to just say that I do not support any elk numbers, and I would like to see them put back into order like the Forest Service wants, put them back down to their numbers like they ought to be on the forest plan. That is the law. And why don't we stand up and uphold the law? That's what I'd like to say.
Thanks, Scott. If that's all the comment cards, what I'd like to task the RAC with is to perhaps address the Fish Lake Plateau change all by itself first. Other things will probably fall into place, but if you want to debate that issue and talk about what we learned here tonight. Mac.
The law, as far as you're concerned, grazers are set for a season of use, period, by law. A season of use, so many days, on and off time, is set in law, and that is not being changed. To my knowledge, can't be changed. Okay? Anyway,
Finish your point, Mac.
The deer herd got in the condition it is today over 30, 40 years to do it. And you're not going to change that in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of decreasing elk or increasing habitat or doing a lot of predator, killing. That's going to take a long time. Yes, we're working on it with these 30-some-odd areas and taking the coyotes out and a few not, but, I still think, and everybody knows on the land, that's been on the land, the elk pushed the deer out. They've done it on the winter range, so the deer are in town. And Sam, address your comment on money ranchers receive from depredation. That's nothing. That's just a Band-Aid every year. It doesn't address the real problem. The real problem is they're devastating private land, period, because there's not enough winter range. That's why they're down there in the fields, elk. Just not enough winter range. You can talk about all the habitats you want. There's just not enough winter range for elk. In fact, I think they ought to be decreased. And Teresa and I have had several talks. They've, on Dutton, a couple of years ago or last year, they collared some elk and followed them around. They summered on Monroe, Fish Lake, Boulder, and some even went to Ponsegon, right? These are some cow elk. So those, and I've advocated since I've been on the rack, the Fish Lake, the Monroe, the Dutton and Boulder elk are all co-mingled. You do not know how many elk you have unless you count them all in the same year, and this was not done last year because of lack of snow. So you really don't know how many elk you have. And I read again from the Forest Service, they do not support an increase. Period. From Curtis Robbins, and Curtis Robbins runs the Fish Lake side from Loa. Jason Kling runs this other side here from Richfield. And then also from the forest supervisors, Dixie and Fish Lake National Forest. They support population numbers identified in existing management plans and keep the population within existing plans. The plan is still at 4,800. And that's where it ought to be. So, anyway, that's all I got to say.
Thanks, Mac. Other rack comments? Dale.
Just one comment. The last meeting, John Keeler spoke of some concerns on the numbers up there on Fish Lake. Mac also spoke on it. And as a rack, we voted, I think it was 9-2 for a depredation, or not a depredation, but for an antlerless hunt, which is one of the tools that was spoke of. But it got voted down at the board meeting. But, I mean, this is a tool that was said here in this meeting that could happen. But if we see the need for it here and it gets voted down up north, then I can see why these guys don't have much faith in that particular tool.
Mike.
I can see both sides of the story, and I'm very sympathetic to both. And sitting here listening to the comments, and especially when it was pointed out that before an elk population can be increased, there should be an analysis of the impacts on the habitat and landowners and livestock and whatever else. And I don't think I've seen the analysis. I've heard talk saying, yeah, it was discussed, or they said it was okay, but when it comes back to what the BLM really, or the BLM questions whether it was okay, and causes me concern that, and the letter from the Forest Service is contrary to what is being proposed here too. So maybe we're putting the cart before the horse by suggesting an increase until we get with the federal land agencies who are responsible for habitat, not the division, but the federal land agencies, and come back with their suggestions on can that habitat sustain increased elk numbers in that area or not. And then put that into the process. My understanding, and Harry, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when, at least on the BLM, I'm not sure how the Forest Service does this, but when there is range improvements done out on the range, they have specific direction on how them increased AUMs are to be used. Some of it will go to wildlife, some of it will go to species of special concern, some of it will go to back to the ranchers and increase the AUMs. And if that's the case and we've got increased AUMs, is that formula or is that direction being followed? And it doesn't sound like, I haven't heard where the BLM has said there's increased AUMs in that area and what number, and I haven't heard where the Forest Service has said that either. So I'm just wondering if we're kind of premature in suggesting numbers at this point, and I would entertain a motion that we look at that, delay this decision until we get those numbers from the federal land agencies and can make a better educated guess.
Is that a motion?
Let me hold off the motion until we get into the main motion.
Other comments? By the rack, Harry.
When I started my career 21 years ago with the BLM, I was a wildlife biologist, and I can see both sides of this coin. I was a big promoter of increases in a lot of different species. As a manager, however, I have to look at all sides of the equation. I sit across the desk from permittees almost weekly who come in and they want to know why they have to decrease their numbers or why we can't increase their numbers or why some of these projects are not going out on the ground and working with them to help them increase. Personally, I can agree to the increase, but I have to speak for BLM. And it goes back to what was just spoken. I don't know if enough time was spent on the ground with the BLM range and wildlife biologists to look at the forage to determine who gets the increase and how that increase is divided up. Several folks said tonight that they support both sides of the issue to some degree, and that's where I'm going with that. I support both sides of the issue, but I don't know if enough analysis was done. And I turn right to the population objective. Again, I mentioned this in the beginning. The objective, ensuring that any increases will be subject to an analysis of the impacts to habitat, landowners, and livestock operators. I don't know if that's happened. It doesn't sound like to me that there was enough time spent on the ground looking at that forage to determine how that forage is going to be allocated. Both sides have a lot invested. I worked a lot with SFW in the past. If it wasn't for some of the work that we did out on the Kaparowitz, we wouldn't have bighorn sheep in some of those areas if it wasn't for SFW. I go back to what Byron said. A lot of money invested on both sides. He indicated, Byron, you're still here, that we need to work together on this, and that's the component I see that might be lacking, is the amount in which we work together to try to determine how that forage is going to be used. I like elk, and I want to see elk increase to a degree, but I also have to work with livestockmen and help them understand what's happening in terms of their permits. And it doesn't look fair to me sometimes if we're going to ask the livestockmen to continue with a reduction or not increase him to some number that he was in the past, yet we go with a number that we're still not completely sure with on elk. I'd like to hear a motion similar to what was suggested a moment ago, to where we see more analysis done on the ground, or at least a different type of analysis, more than just range rides. It's getting out on the ground with the federal
folks, with the range staff, with the wildlife staff, and looking at that forage and letting the livestock permittee go out on the ground with them so that everybody can be there and working together to see what those, how those numbers are going to pan out.
Thanks, Harry. Sam.
Well, I sit here representing sportsmen, and my heart's with the cattlemen on this, who are agriculture. I served on the Ponsagon Elk Committee. We had several of the livestock people on that committee. Each and every one of them testified that they have had deer populations on their property for years and years. The elk have moved in. There are no more deer there. The deer have moved off. And we talk about there's no scientific studies or anything to preclude or to prove that cattle or that deer and elk will not cohabitate. We do know that they do. There is a study out there for people to read, the Sharkey study that was done, I believe, in Oregon. That has an awful lot of information on deer and elk and cattle interactions. So there is stuff out there that can be researched and looked at, and there are studies that the bottom line of those studies more or less said that the deer and elk do cohabitate, but when push comes to shove, the elk are going to win every time. On this particular issue, I'm not familiar with the Fish Lake, but on the Ponsagon, when we got together and made a decision, we decided to cut the elk on there. It's a premium deer unit, and there was enough evidence and testimony there that we went that direction on the Ponsagon. Being stuck here representing sportsmen and knowing what I represent, what I have seen in my lifetime on the Ponsagon, I can remember when we had no elk on the Ponsagon, very few. And that has certainly changed in the last 15 years, and it has affected where the deer hang out. As far as it affecting the population, it's like people have testified here tonight. There is no proof that elk displace or affect the population of the deer. But I'm going to have to abstain on this vote because I don't feel fair that I can represent the sportsmen and vote with them when I see the other issues that we're talking about here with we need continued studies. And I just would like to see, like Mr. Worthen has suggested, that a little more research done on this particular unit to make a decision that everybody will be able to live with.
More discussion. Cordell.
Yeah, I'd just like to reiterate what Sam just said. Both parties, and I know SFW and I know all the sportsmen's group have put thousands and thousands of dollars into habitation for elk and deer. I also have some very good friends sitting down there. It's from my county, and I know that livestock is their livelihood, sheep. I want to go back to where them was, and just, I'm saying this, and it's nothing against anybody. Before we ever had elk on the Beaver Mountain, I can remember my dad used to run cattle on the Beaver Mountain. And when I graduated from high school, we was down to 4 head of cows. We got cut every single year, and there was no elk. I think sometimes we blame the wrong people. Okay? I don't have that say. Forest Service and BLM has that say. But every time that you guys get cut, there's always a statement in there about the elk. Okay? I know elk create havoc. I know they do. I think as far as me taking a vote on this, and I have friends on both sides of this issue, and I feel very, very deeply about it. I mean, I like to hunt. Everybody likes to hunt. Okay? But I also understand what you're going through. And I'll be honest with you right now. I've seen both sides. And I know all this money's been put in, and I think that we need... They just talked about the Ponsagon, what they've done. Okay? It's a deer area. They don't want elk, period. Okay? Well, bottom line is, we're going to have elk somewhere. All right?
But maybe these groups that ought to get together that have this problem and figure out what the problem is and how we can solve this problem. Because let me tell you what, sportsmen and livestock owners, trust me, we're one and the same, and we're fighting this battle because they would love these environmentalists and all this BS that's going on to kick you off the mountain with your cows and to kick all of us off the mountain from hunting. And then we could all sit down in our cars and look at the mountain and say, oh, isn't that beautiful? And not one person would get to use anything. So I think we need to stop fighting against each other and help each other. And I'm not saying, I mean, Max came up with a thing on the fish lake. I know how you cattlemen feel about elk, but I also know how the sportsmen feel. And tonight I've heard things from I don't know how the BLM voted in that meeting. Because I've heard they voted one way and I've heard they voted another way here tonight. And the Forest Service the same way. Now I know Max got this letter, okay? But in that elk meeting, that's why these meetings are set up, is so everybody's involved. Everybody has a say, and it should be an even amount of number on both sides to where they don't stack the meeting, okay? And I don't know if that's what happened. I'm just saying that, you know, and I want to get back to what Stanton said about the cougars. I'll tell you what, I've chased cougars my whole life, and I don't think we will ever have a deer herd until we kill every one of them sons of bees, and I wish there was something that this board could do about it, but we can't. We have to live by the laws, and trust me, it's environmentalists, friends of the animals, okay, and other people involved, why we can't kill more cougars. But I know how many deer cougars kill, and they kill a whole lot of them. And until we see a whole bunch of cougars taken off these ranges, we're never going to have no deer. That's all I got to say.
Thanks, Cordell. Claire.
I love to hear Cordell speak. He's so eloquent over there. You ought to run for something, Cordell. I just want to throw my wholehearted support behind this increase in elk. Anybody that's been listening to me for the last 6 years know I love elk. They're a regal animal. They're the best tasting piece of meat the Lord created. I just wish we could have got to that 80,000 with this plan. That's all.
Thanks, Claire. Other comments? And on the end, Dave.
I'd just like to say, too, that I see and I live with both sides of this equation, and I, too, wish that we could be partners in this fight, because I think the people we need to fight are the environmental groups. They're trying to destroy a lifestyle that we've enjoyed all of our lives. The thing that concerns me, though, is the feeling that I got out of the meeting that I went to is I felt like both sides agreed that we could support an increase in cattle and livestock and sheep. We could also support an increase in elk and deer. And I would be glad to sit on a committee or help in any way I could to increase the number of permits for livestock. That's what my father-in-law does as a living. It's an injustice what you guys have gone through. But we're here tonight to talk about elk. And I wish I could vote for cattle and sheep, but I can't. But I can vote for the elk. I was a little disheartened. There's representatives there from the Forest Service and the BLM. Their personal opinions did not reflect the opinions of their supervisors. I feel like if there's any more studies being done, we will also see the results and the opinions of their supervisors and not the people that are on the ground that understand the properties. And I think that we can support both additional cattle and sheep and elk. But the results of those studies will say no more increases, period, regardless of what's out in the field. My vote tonight would be to approve the plan as presented by the DWR.
Ryan.
You guys thought I wasn't going to say anything.
I mean, this is such a tough issue, and I just want to echo what he just said about we can't vote on cows and sheep tonight. We're here to vote with, you know, vote on an elk and a deer management plan. And I just, 62%, somebody said 62% of the people hate government, and it's because we have a study to have a study to have a study to have a study on the study we didn't have. And it's, I don't know. I'm getting some conflicting things here. I just think that then there's that much invested from sportsmen that's such a huge body of the public. If we don't vote to throw something back to them in a couple of increases in elk on some units, there's going to be elk on some units. There's going to be deer on others. I mean, part of this plan, I mean, I just, we got to decide where we want elk and where we want deer, and we're going to have to deal with that. So I would support the division's recommendations.
Other right comments? Sure, Mike. You ready to make that motion?
I'm getting ready there. One thing I want to make clear that I'm not opposed to elk and I'm not opposed to increased cattle. I am opposed to decreased cattle if the elk are going to increase. And therefore, I think it's wise that we back up. It's not going to be that long that we back up and say, hey, let's get the factions together and see how much increased forage is out there and then work out an allocation plan. And if it comes up to increased cattle and increased elk, that would be great. And I would support whatever that group, that effort comes up with. So with that, let me make a motion that we send it back to the division and ask them to do a more thorough analysis of how much forage is on the fish lake that equates to MOUs, and then get with the
AUMs.
Or AUMs, excuse me. And then get with the cattlemen, the sportsmen, the interested groups, and work out some type of compromise on what each would get out of this, rather than just roll over one group for the benefit of another. So that's my motion.
Will you do Gianni a favor and restate that in 25 words or less?
That we table the suggested increase of 800 elk on the fish lake and do a more thorough analysis that includes number of increased AUMs out there and negotiations with the permitted users and the sportsmen and other interest groups.
Thanks. Motion by Mike. Is there a second? Second by Mac. Discussion on the motion? As it just pertains to the fish lake?
Maybe.
Dave.
I guess my question would be is how realistic will this happen, or will we just miss out on an opportunity to vote and the Wildlife Board will make a decision for us?
It's a valid question. They're the ultimate authority.
So we can recommend that we study this thing, and all we're doing is missing an opportunity to express our real opinion on how this should turn out.
Claire.
I would move that we to amend the motion to pass the elk management plan as the division has proposed it, with Mike's recommendation that they do a more thorough investigation to substantiate what they are and prove what they are proposing is sound, but that we do pass the motion pass the plan as presented.
You know, it doesn't really impact that motion. It's rather independent. If you want to make that as a separate motion, we can vote on this plateau unit alone and then make a second motion on the balance. That's what I prefer to do.
I would hate to see the plateau excluded from my motion. That is our main concern tonight.
Okay. Do you want to amend your motion to include everything else? Is the amendment seconded by anyone?
I don't understand.
What it is in essence is Claire's tying the rest of the elk management plan and the objectives as presented,
including
the plateau. So we're voting on it all. He's declined to include that. So now the amendment is all by itself, which is the balance of the plan. So the fish lake has been carved out. The amended motion is the rest of the elk plan is recommended. Is that seconded?
No, that's not what I proposed.
Restate.
I move that we amend his proposal to include the whole elk plan, including fish lake, but we attach his amendment or his motion as a recommendation to study that fish lake area. But I move that we approve the whole plan. You can figure that out.
Chair Mike.
Does that mean in your amendment that the fish lake would include the 800 increase, or would that be tabled as the motion was?
No, that would include the 800 increase. I've seen no evidence that we shouldn't include that.
There's a lot of overlap in these motions and lots of confusion up here. Harry.
I'm confused, but I guess the question I have is when we talk about going back and doing this study, I'm not talking about a big study. I was talking about AUMs, looking at how many AUMs are involved in these treatments and breaking those AUMs down by how many AUMs are going to go to wildlife, elk, and how many AUMs may go to livestock. And that's up for the agencies to determine whether that can happen or not. The problem I see with this last motion is what we're, in my mind, saying is we're going to approve it. Then we're going to go see how many AUMs there are. And if the AUMs aren't there, how do we back up? It's kind of like writing checks out before you know money's in the bank, but you're going to go ahead and write the checks. And then when you come later and find out the money's not there, how do you back out of that?
Yeah, and your comments are specific to the plateau.
Specific to the plateau.
We've got a motion on the table and an amendment to that motion, but there's a lot of conflict and overlap between those motions, and is there a second on the motion? On the amended motion? That motion dies for lack of second. Let's go back to the original motion.
There you go.
Discussion on the motion by... seconded by Mac. Cordell.
Okay, I just got a question for Vance. Okay? You, as a biologist for the fish and game, have you done an analysis or anything on the fish lake saying that it will substantiate 800 more elk?
Yeah, that's a good question, and we don't have a mechanism to do that. I would actually, if you would like, have Chris Colton from the BLM come and talk, even if those measurements are done. I don't know how that's calculated, the AUMs, available AUMs. Could you clarify that?
In the essence of time, Vance, okay. If it's okay with you,
sure.
I'm one of those darn federal biologists. What this sounds like to me is, in the rack chair hat, is a lot like the Henry Mountains bison issue. And though it's not the perfect paradigm or the perfect model for how to work these details out, that's a lot different group than the group that was formed for the elk management plan revision. That has grazing specialists, it has all the permittees at the table that might be affected, private landowners, and that sounds like where this may morph into if we pass this motion we haven't even voted on yet. So let's deal with this motion, and Cordell, with all due respect to your question, they didn't look real deep. We're not looking at AUM allocation. The Forest Service doesn't allocate forage necessarily specifically to wild ungulates. I'd like to vote on this motion after some discussion up here conceptually, and as whether we're tabling the plateau for now with a recommendation to the Wildlife Board that we form some sort of group like that, if that's what the RAC's thinking about, and then we move on with the rest of the agenda.
Okay, I'd just like a little clarification on the motion. What is it right now?
John, do you want to read that? It's 4 pages up. That's the motion on the table. Further discussion on the motion, I'd like to call a vote.
I'd like to. I'm deaf.
Can you repeat that, please? We couldn't hear.
Enter mic,
please.
It's hard to hear.
You get to hear yourself on the recording now.
To table the suggested increase of 800 elk on the fish lake and do a more thorough analysis of the number of AUMs available with respect to grazing and sportsman needs. Does that sound like what you said?
Is that the motion you made? Is that the motion you seconded, Mac? Are we ready to call a vote on this motion? Those in favor, please hold your hands up till we can count you. Those in favor of the motion. The motion we just read.
In favor or not?
In favor. Hold them up. You get them counted? This is the vote in favor of the motion. Those against. Sam abstained. Hold them up.
Is this against?
Yeah. This is against.
Never pass on.
There you go.
Okay.
Sam.
Thanks.
What's the count? 5-6 against?
5 in favor, 6 against.
Motion fails. Pray for another motion. Claire wants to take the stand.
I'll get it right this time. I move that we approve the elk management plan as presented by the DWR.
Motion by Claire. Seconded by Lane. Discussion on the motion.
I know that we mentioned writing checks before we had money in there. Would you object an amendment to the motion of putting together a group to get some people on the ground? You're saying with the committee, the local elk committee has already had 16 people on the ground. Okay, I'll just this is just part of the discussion part.
Yeah.
Don't throw rocks at me. Sorry.
Further discussion on the motion on the table? Let's call a vote. Those in favor, please, hold them up. Those against. Sam, you didn't vote. What's the count? Motion passes. Let's take a 15-minute recess.
Somewhere cooler to go to.
Yeah.
Like, no better.
Where
We're trying to get organized up here. People want to gather their seats up. Moving on to conservation permit rule amendment. Kevin Bunnell.
Did we approve the rest of the
outline? That was a motion.
Thank you, Steve, and members of the RAC. We, as you're probably aware, we issue most of the conservation permits on a three-year rotation, and every year as that's coming up, we look over the rule with the groups and make sure everything's still working right. We've got a couple of recommended changes that I'll go through at the end. But before that, I wanted to just give you some history of the rule and where it's been and some of the accomplishments, and also hit briefly on the legislative audit that took place this last year of the program. So the history, it began in 1991 with a single desert sheep permit that was marketed by the division. In 1990, it was shortly after that expanded to a maximum of one permit per species through 1994. And then in 1997, it began to grow fairly rapidly. Just to give you an idea of that growth, from 91 through 98, the program raised a total of $1.3 million. In the next five-year period, so in the first 17 years, $1.3 million. The next 5 years, 5.7. The next 5 years after that, 12.5. And then in the last 2 years, the program's raised $5.3 million, so a total of about $25 million since 1981. Looks like I went too far. Look at some of the regulation history. So in 1999, the maximum number of area permits per species was capped at 8. We included an evaluation formula for past performance for the groups that participate, and added a stipulation that the recipient may designate another person for a permit if they're successful in the regular big game draw, so they don't end up with two permits. In 2000, we clarified that the money can be used for other than the species that generate it if it's agreed upon both by the groups and the division, and we added turkey, cougar, and bear statewide conservation permits. Then in 2002, we clarified that we can only have one application per conservation organization, clarified that the Wildlife Board can select a recipient other than the high bidder after considering a set of four criteria. We put in criteria for limiting the growth of the program, and then the board can authorize a second statewide conservation permit for a special event or purpose. Continuing on in 2003, these are mostly clarifications. It was how the program was running anyway, but 90% of the funds raised must be used on projects that benefit conservation permit species. We put in auditing and accounting procedures, and then project reporting and approval procedures were also added. Then in 2006, we defined what a conservation permit species was, and that's deer, elk, pronghorn, moose, bison, bighorn, sheep, turkey, cougar, and bear. In 2006, we instituted the multi-year program and define the procedures that govern that, and then we made an exception to allow for 10% of bighorn sheep permits to be used as conservation permits, where the rest are limited to 5%. In 2007, we added that the person identified on the permit or voucher must also have a current hunting license. That's the same time we required everybody that applies in our draws to have a license before they can apply for a permit. And then in 2010, we added the special Antelope Island permits for mule deer and bighorn sheep. They must be authorized both by the Wildlife Board and the Parks Board, and the revenue generated by those two permits goes to the State Parks Service, not to the division. Just to hit briefly on the legislative audit, the 2011 legislature requested that this program be audited. And just the auditor's conclusion kind of sums it up. It says the sale of conservation permits promotes habitat improvements on public lands with no expense to the taxpayer while negligibly reducing the public's opportunity to draw a permit for limited entry hunting area, and we would encourage the division to continue to support this program. That was the conclusion of the legislative audit. So just to hit briefly on some accomplishments, The program has contributed to over to 309 different projects since 2006. Those are habitat projects, the kind of things that we were talking about just earlier on the elk plan discussion. We've conducted multiple big game transplants, including at least 561 bighorn sheep, 350 pronghorn, and 80 bison, and supported several current research efforts, highway mortality studies that are going on, the effects of predator on mule deer, which is a study that's just getting started here on Monroe Mountain, the mule deer fawn and doe and fawn survival, the collar data that you've probably heard about, and then we're beginning a moose survival study this coming year. So now moving into the recommended changes. The first is to allow turkey conservation permit holders to hunt statewide during the general season or over-the-counter turkey hunt. That's just to kind of make it consistent with now having over-the-counter turkey hunting. And then just some clarifications to define that the potential number of multi-year conservation permits is calculated based on the number of permits issued the year prior to the permits being awarded. So we will issue multi-year conservation permits for 2013, 14, and 15 based on the 2012, the number of permits that are issued that were just passed by the board for the 2012 season. And then we included a table. And there's some confusion out there that this is an increase. In fact, this is exactly the way the permits have been being calculated for several years. We're not trying to increase the permit or increase the program or grow the program. This is simply to try to add transparency so that everybody knows exactly what the cutoffs are. And this is the exact rule that's been being used up to this point in terms of calculating the number of permits. And there's two tables in there, one for the bighorn sheep, which is based on 10%, and one for the others, which is based on 5%. Another one is to include an option and a mechanism for reducing the number of conservation permits for once-in-a-lifetime species if the number of public permits declines during the time period for which multi-permits were awarded. That really came about because of what's happened with moose over the last 3 years. We issued conservation permits 3 years ago based on would have been about 2008 moose tags. Well, since 2008, moose tags have been reduced in the public draw fairly dramatically. But since the conservation permits were calculated based on better times, that the percentages got out of balance. And so the groups agree that we need to have a mechanism in there that if we see a trend like that, that we can go in and pull out some of the conservation permits mid-cycle before we get to the next three-year period. And then lastly, we're recommending that we change the timing for when funds are transferred from the groups to the division. Currently, the division invoices the organizations after a project's completed. The problem with that is they bid a certain amount. What we project what the project's going to cost, oftentimes those projects will come in under budget. I know which seems odd for the way the government works, but we actually do that quite a bit with our habitat work. And that throws the balance sheets off with the groups because they have taken a certain amount off of what they bid and then they get invoiced for a lesser amount. That just puts the burden of keeping track of those differences on the division rather than on the groups. And so what we would do is we'd carry over a balance for the next time that they bid on projects and contribute that to what they're bringing to the meeting on their own. And that's it. Be glad to answer any questions.
Kim, did you mention how much money on an annual basis are we talking about associated with this rule?
I had it broke down in 5 years. In the last 2 years, I think it was $5.3 million. We're raising, roughly $2.5 million a year right now.
Questions for Kevin? Lane?
Under the current plan, go back to that slide you were just on. On the change the timing of the funds transferred to the division, under the current plan, that money stays with the conservation organization. I mean, they have the opportunity to bank that money and draw interest on it until the project is completed.
Until they're invoiced for it, yeah.
But with the recommendation, you're talking about if the project, once it's planned and bid or appropriated for.
Once they allocate their funds or the funds that they've raised through the project raised through the program to a specific project, we would invoice them for the amount that they have agreed to contribute within 90 days after they make the commitment.
Okay.
It'll change it by about 6 or 8 months in terms of when the money gets transferred.
But it's fresher on everybody's mind.
That was my next question, is that will change it by 6 to 8 months?
Yeah, somewhere between 6-9. The invoice is a little different every year based on when we complete projects.
Isn't there, and as I was reading through my packet, isn't there a rule in place? Isn't there like a September 1st cutoff on all those?
By projects? September 1st, they have to report what they raised through their banquets the previous year.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
I follow you.
Yeah.
Sure, Mike.
Kevin, is there any mechanism in place, like what's the total number of desert bighorn, for instance, conservation permits? Is it 5, 6, 7? Can all 5 or 6 of those go in one unit that only has 3 public tags, thus that unit be over harvested?
No. the way it works right now is they can combine units, or we can combine units to get up to a minimum of 5, which puts 1 conservation permit on those 2 units combined. And that's the most that could be there on once you combine to get up to the minimum number.
Okay, so if one unit has 3 and another one has 2, then that gives you your 5.
And you and one
then
of them.
One conservation.
Right.
But on those conservation units, you may have 5 of those statewide.
No,
they're
specific to those units.
Okay.
Specific to the units. There is one, what do we call sportsman's tag for each species that's statewide, but there's only one of those per species.
Thank you.
Other questions? Dale.
Okay, you've got a mechanism built in for once in a lifetime, but is there anything for limited entry elk?
There isn't.
As far as downturn in permit numbers for public as opposed to conservation permits?
There isn't, because we haven't seen a need for that. So, I mean, we've been growing in general the number of limited entry elk tags, and so it goes both ways. Not only we don't take them back if they go down, but we don't increase them during the 3-year period if they go up. And so during the last 3-year period, the number of limited entry elk tags is way higher than it was in 2009, and yet there was no increase. So those increases only come once every 3 years.
Okay, and I can agree with that, but there are some units. Monroe in 09, you were up in the hundreds, 130 permits or something when these were approved. Since that time, you're down to 35 tags this year, 6 conservation permits this year. I mean, that's a pretty high percentage of that small allotment. Beaver, I mean, you've gone down to 45 permits, and you're at 4 conservation permits. I mean, I don't look at every unit, but there's some scenarios where the public is losing tags, and those conservation tags are staying
the same. There are some examples of that, Dale, for sure. At this time, you know, we wanted to put the mechanism in for once-in-a-lifetime species. Certainly, once that's in there, that opens the door for using a similar thing down the road. So.
Okay. Other questions? Questions from the public? Both of you? I don't have any comment cards.
Can you tell what people are passionate about?
Yeah. It's yours to deal with.
I make a motion, Mr. Chairman, that we accept the presentation as per Kevin's presentation.
Motion by Lane. Is there a second? Seconded by Mike Worthen. Any discussion on that motion? And those in favor of the motion? Any against? That looks unanimous. Thanks, Kevin. The infamous CIP amendment.
Good evening. My name is Paul Birdsey. I'm the Cold Water Sport Fish Coordinator from Salt Lake. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you about the collection and importation and possession rule. Some of you may remember that we brought this rule out about a year and a half ago. During the RAC process, at that time, however, there were some significant shortcomings that were identified as part of that rule. So it was taken back to a drawing board. Hopefully, they've all been squared away, and we're bringing it out again. I'm going to give you a brief overview of just all of the changes that are being proposed, not just those things that have been amended as a result of the last RAC tour, because I understand that there are some new RAC members that may not be familiar with everything that's being proposed. Okay, first of all, what is a CIP? It's a cooperative rule with the DWR, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Health, and its purpose is to regulate the possession of wildlife, protect the health and safety of the public, and protect genetic integrity of wildlife and livestock. It provides a mechanism for the DWR to regulate activities for protected wildlife unrelated to fishing or hunting. And it governs the issuance of certificates of registration for possession and propagation of protected wildlife, and it defines those activities. The CIP has three wildlife classifications. There's non-controlled, which there's no detrimental impact, and COR is not required. There's controlled, which there's possible detrimental impact to the population, and COR is required. And then finally, prohibited species, which there's significant detrimental impact from that species, and COR is only issued in accordance with CIP rule and federal laws. Species that are not covered by this rule, these are either being added or clarified. One is a cat, and it recognizes only those that are recognized domestic breeds, dog, which are domestic and hybrids, and swine. Some definitions that have been either revised or just added. Domestic relates to those animals that are common domestic or considered common domestics. The term animal was revised to include hybrids between domestic and wild animals. And probably the biggest change that we're bringing out right now is a change in the definition of ornamental fish to ornamental aquatic animal species. And that change was necessitated because ornamental fish, kind of by definition, does not include crustaceans and mollusks, as invertebrates, and those particular animals are, in fact, covered by this rule. And they are, the ornamental refers to those that are commonly found in the aquaculture industry. I will tell you that probably in a year or so, we're going to want to come out and talk with the RACs and the Wildlife Board about those animals that are available through the aquaculture industry, because we are currently working on an invasive species plan or an illegal introduction plan, and we're finding that a lot of those illegal introductions originate in the pet trade. But right now, we don't know what those animals are, what kind of risk they present, so we can't give you a list of which ones we want to, you know, allow and which ones we're going to eventually have to ask to be prohibited. This definition does not include sport fish, bait fish, food fish, native species, prohibited or controlled species. This definition is also found in three other rules, and that is the aquaculture and fish stocking rule, the fish ponds rule, and the brine shrimp rule. And I need to tell you, if you agree to the change that we're presenting here tonight, that definition will be revised in two of those rules for the aquaculture and for the fish ponds, We're not going to open up the brine shrimp rule at this point in time, even to revise its definition, because it's a very complex rule that's up for revision in another year or so anyway. So we'll just tackle this at that time. Okay, just a couple of specific rules for the crustaceans and mollusks that I talked about. You have the Pylos crayfish. It's the only native crayfish in Utah. It's prohibited for possession, and it has threats from two introduced species of crayfish. And then there's an amphipod, which is a small invertebrate found in streams. This one happens to be endemic. It's only found in one cave in Duchesne County. It's been petitioned to list under the Endangered Species Act. The Fish and Wildlife Service determined that that listing was not substantial, which simply means that the petitioners did not present enough information in their petition to warrant further review. It could, in fact, be petitioned again. Moving on, some more crustaceans and mollusks. We have the floater, which Kevin told me I'm supposed to tell you does not have anything to do with what occasionally found in public swimming pools. This is a clam, a bivalve. It's listed in the rule currently as a California floater. There's actually many different species of the genus Anadonta, so we just want to include all of them. We're also including the spring snails, which are found, many of them are found just in small springs in the West Desert. Continuing with that, there's a native terrestrial snail. These are also prohibited. This first one has also been petitioned for listing. Again, the petition was not found to be not substantial. You have the western pearl shell, which is a mussel that hasn't been seen since 1940, but on the other hand, no one's looked either. So we don't quite know what the status of that one is. And finally, we have the red-rimmed melanoides snail. This one's a non-native, and it's causing a lot of problems in some of those springs that I mentioned earlier. We're adding some new language, and it just basically is to clarify, this is for clarification purposes only. All native species not listed in subsection 1 and 2, excluding ornamental aquatic animal species, are classified as controlled for collection, importation, and possession. And then we're adding all non-native species not listed in subsection 1 and 2 and excluding ornamental aquatic animal species are classified as prohibited. So native species, if they're not in the list, we're just saying they're all controlled. The non-native, if they're not on the list, they're classified as prohibited. Adding three species of fish to the prohibited, blue catfish, emerald shiner, and burbot. These are all non-native species with detrimental impacts of native species. Mammals. Making this rule consistent with the non-game mammal rule, R657-19, except as prohibited in the non-game mammals rule, a person is allowed to kill non-game animals that are causing damage to their property or crops.
Hey, Paul.
Yes.
I don't mean any disrespect, but if you, in the essence of time, does anybody have heartburn if we cut to the chase on this? Very few public here. It's after 10 o'clock. Is that okay, Paul?
It's fine with me. You can make that decision 15 minutes ago.
We've had the material in our packet. The public have had the material.
It's a threat of killing me. Back years ago, it's in board system, when we made that treaty with Mexico, the crows and ravens got protected.
Yes.
Hang that microphone. This is it.
Okay.
I want to make
Thanks, Paul. Two Pauls.
Okay. 100 years ago, we made this treaty with Mexico, and through that treaty, the crows and the magpies and the ravens got protected. And you couldn't shoot them in Utah. Well, anyway, then I went to the board. I took some samples. They gave me a permit to take some magpies. We drew blood on them. Warren Harvard used to be a turkey guy here, and he knew how to draw blood, and we sent it to the labs, and they proved they carried titers for disease, and we got some vegetables out of these vegetable plots that they were doing in Sevier County then, where they'd go in and eat the hearts out of, like, the lettuce and different things. Anyway, I went to the board, and the board, in that meeting, made it legal to shoot crows and magpies. Now, somewhere, you can't touch ravens, I know that, but somewhere through all this, now nobody seems to know, and I've been right from about the top down and the bottom up on this, if you could actually kill a crow or a magpie. And I think they'd come under this, but is that a question you can answer?
Kevin Bunnell.
Kevin.
Kevin.
Okay.
It's really the Fish and Wildlife Service's purview, isn't it?
No. Ravens, that's about the only way to kill a raven.
In a couple more slides, you would have seen magpies are added to the list that there's no COR required if there's damage being done, and that includes cowbirds and several others. Crows are a different story. We could issue a COR, so they're under a different classification for someone to take crows, but it can't be done just without a COR. So there's a mechanism to do that with crows. Magpies. They do.
Not if it's on your private land doing damage.
There you go.
They need to shoot it.
Or give you permission.
Or give you permission.
So. Keep sage grouse from closing down all these units, and those things are eating those eggs, and you know that. Let's address that.
Ravens are, and that is being addressed in a big way, DeLoss. There's tens of thousands of poison eggs put out specifically for ravens every year.
Yeah, that's going on.
Well, let's shoot a few of them.
Well, that ravens are an issue that are out of our purview. Well, it's the federal agency that does it, and they have a permit to do so.
Okay, back to my question.
Magpies, yes. Crows, no.
Excellent. Other questions?
Sorry.
No, that's what we're here for. That's what he's here for. Excellent. I don't have any comment cards, questions from the rack. Mike.
One quick question on feral swine. Feral hogs. How is the Department of Ag over that, or who regulates
yes,
the feral swine?
Yes, exactly. So this one's a little bit complicated because species-wise, feral pigs or swine and Russian boars are the same species. But we delineate if it's a wild. If anybody could prove that it had come from a wild source, we would have authority, but we're excluding domestic or feral, meaning that they've come from a domestic source because the Department of Agriculture has the authority there.
Kevin, don't go away.
This is more questions than we had the first time we did this.
I know. I know that, and I don't know this for a fact, but apparently through the legislature this year there was a feral swine issue that came up about shutting down these commercial pig hunting operations, like the one in Price, the one up to Corinne. Those are the only two I know about. Do you know the status of that?
Well, that's part of the reason that we've made it clear in here that Department of Ag has authority there, because there was some question. And so we're part of this effort is to make it very clear if they're domestic, it's Department of Ag's purview. If they're from a wild source, then they're ours.
So those commercial hunting operations that are in operation now, you guys don't have any jurisdiction over those?
No.
Okay.
Good questions. Any others? No comment cards. It's ours to deal with.
Make a motion that we accept CIP as proposed.
Motion by Brian. Second by Sam. Any discussion? Those in favor? Any against? That looks unanimous. Greg Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and RAC members. Last month, I started at 10:45 p.m., so we're making progress. And my voice is here this time, too. I'll try to move very quickly through this so we can go home. Yeah, we started at 5 last month. Okay. It's called the Vision Variance Rule. It's R657-57. Quick background what this is. I'll make this short and sweet. If something happens to you, you've drawn a permit for elk, once in a lifetime, whatever, and you become ill or injured, or someone does in your family, before the hunting season gets here, we put a rule in place about 4 years ago that said we created a division committee so we can have you come to us, address your problem to us, and then we can, the board gave us some authority to grant relief to these individuals. And typically what that relief was is that we'd extend your season till the next year. And some of the reasons we did it, you can see on this graph about 60% of those that we did were for people who were injured or ill, or else 32%, about a third, for someone in their family, and then military and others made up a few percent. So basically it's people who got injured. The situation we had before we put this rule in place, we were running about 20 of these a year, and they were all going to the Wildlife Board, and that's why the board said, why don't you guys come up with a rule so we don't have to deal with 20 of these a year? So we thought we had a pretty good rule that said, well, we'll just let the division do it, and you can, we'll send a few to the board if there's something awkward about it that we can't deal with. Somewhere along the way, the word got on that something happened to you. You can have a season extension in the next year, and you can kind of see what's going on. Our concern is that this probably isn't a pattern that we want to keep moving on with. You can see here, the ones in blue are the ones that the division is now addressing, the quantity. The ones in red are the ones that that still have to go to the Wildlife Board. Typically, the ones that go to the Wildlife Board are because somebody went and hunted for a few days and then got hurt before they harvested. And then they came to the division and said, I've waited for 18 years, you know, for this elk permit. I fell off my horse, broke my leg. Can I hunt next year? I haven't harvested yet. So the division rule didn't allow for us to extend those. They can't have hunted as the only ones we could have addressed. So most of these red ones are people who already hunted. So what we're trying to do here is change this rule so that we're not have this growth going on like we saw of these permit extensions into the next season. But we're trying to still be fair to people, realizing that things happen in your life. And we want to be the fairest that we can to help address those situations. So what we're saying is that we can still grant a variance to people who have these things happen if you're substantially precluded from hunting. And the old rule said you got up till 200 days after the season ends to come talk to us about it. So if you're in the hospital or whatever, we're lowering that to 120 days, so we're not stretching this out quite so far. There's still no guarantee, because when you come in and say, I'm injured, you know, maybe you twisted your ankle, we got to kind of decide how bad you really hurt, you know. But for the most part, we do approve these that come through. Now, substantially precluded, this is a new thing. Before, we said, if you hunted at all, we can't help you. You got to go talk to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board was approving most of these ones that came to him, so they said, here's what we want the new, well, here's what we're proposing. The new rule be that if you hunted for up to a day and didn't harvest, and then you got injured or ill or whatever, you could still come and ask for some relief from the division. So we're kind of saying, you know, we'll give you a day of hunting or something, in a single day. So there's variances are limited to, the new proposal is we can waive future waiting periods, and I'll talk about this in a second, or we can just give you back your bonus or preference points plus the one you would have earned that year, if that makes sense. So if you had 18 points going in and you drew it and then something happens to you, we'll give you 18 back plus the one you'd have earned if you'd have just bought a point that year. We're trying to make you sort of whole as though you'd never drawn this thing. Or else, in some cases, we're still proposing a season extension. I'll show you those. So the ones that we give you your preference points back. Now, preference point species are these ones. General deer, antlerless deer, doe, swan. You can read them there. So no season extension. So if something happens to you and you got one of these general tags, we're just saying here, you know, you can get your preference point back plus earn one. And that's how we're going to try to make you whole here. You're still not going to get your money back for these. Okay, bonus point. So if for species you had bonus points on, these are usually a little harder to draw, of course, we'd still give you your points back. And the species would be once-in-a-lifetime, limited entry, public CWMUs, et cetera. But we wouldn't extend them into next year. Now, we've had some internal discussions. People say, well, what if you moved once in a lifetime and let you have a season extension on that? Because there aren't high volumes of them, and it's so darn hard to get these things in the first place. So we had some discussion if we should maybe allow once in a lifetime to have a season extension. But our recommendation here for you tonight is to just give you your points back. But I wanted you to know some of the things we talked about. Now, there's two categories here that might frustrate some people. If you've drawn a sportsman's tag or a convention permit, we can make you whole by waiving a waiting period so you can apply again, but we're not going to extend it. So if you do one of those things, you're kind of too bad for you. We don't have any points to give you back or anything else. We can say you're eligible to keep applying in the future, but we can't. There's not a lot of relief we can grant you with those types of permits. Now, season extensions would be conservation permits, poaching reward, private CWMU, subject to landowner approval, and limited entry landowner. Let me explain why we put those for season extensions. Typically, a lot of these permits are sold except for the poaching reward ones, and we only do just a few of those a year. Most of these have some money associated with them. People come in and have paid money, whether it's conservation permit, a private CWMU, potentially 6 or 8, 10 months before a season ever happens. And then they go clear to the season, and then they can contact us under our proposal for up to 120 days after the hunt. So, and in the current rule, it's 200 days. These people could have paid this money a year before we ever had a discussion with them for these sort of permits. And it's hard for us to say, well, you paid 10 grand, 20, 100, whatever, 200,000 for one of these. Go talk to them and see if they'll give your money back a year after the fact, when we've probably, you know, either the private landowners or the division itself may have already gone and spent that money. Kevin just talked about the real world conservation groups. As soon as they agree to a project, they got to give us all the money. They don't necessarily have any money to give back to these people. So we are proposing an extension on these. And on the CWMUs, the private, those guys would have to go talk to the landowner. We're not going to do it for them. They can talk to the landowner, and the landowner will extend it till next year, and add that on top of their next year quota, because you save an elk this year, maybe you can shoot it next year, then we could agree to that. So groups, this is another kind of tricky one. Group members receive the same variance relief granted by the division. So when I say group, I'm talking formal groups who applied together in the drawing. So if there's two of you applied in a group and one of you became ill or injured and couldn't participate, we'd be willing to let the other group member have the same relief so they could also turn their permit in and get their points back. What we've run into some on some of the ones we've approved is that these people, maybe they're non-residents or even they're residents, they want to kind of hunt together. So what we're saying is if you drew it together, we'll let you undraw it together. So that's what we're offering for groups there. A couple situations here. The board cannot consider a variance. And for if any of these time frames have passed, right now the Wildlife Board can grant a variance to most anything that they create. You can go and appeal just about anything to the Wildlife Board. What we're writing here is a provision that says they can't hear, no matter as much as they want to, they can't hear an appeal of this stuff. If it's more than 120 days, if they hunted, I should say one day or more. It says two, but if it's they hunted more than one day, season extension, beyond a year animals killed. If any of those happen, they can't appeal it. Because what we run into, as soon as we tell people, no, sorry, you know, you got hurt or these bad things happened in your life, they say, well, forget you, division committee, we're going to go talk to the board. And so it just becomes a stepping stone to get to the board, and we don't want to push all this to the board. So the rule will say, board, you can't hear it. If the division criteria didn't follow through, there's nothing you can do about it either. So I know that's a lot, and it's kind of confusing. We don't normally talk about these issues here at the RACs a lot, but be glad to address any questions. Thank you.
We've all sat through lots of these at the Wildlife Board, and they are difficult issues to deal with. Any questions for Greg? Questions from the public? I don't have any comment cards. Hard to deal with.
I have a question. I fear getting shot here. I know everyone wants to go home, but this mentioned with a once in a lifetime, there had been a lot of internal discussion about saying the way you're proposing it, just so I'm clear, that you would just give their bonus point back and move those guys back into the draw with no extension of the tag if they break their leg the opening morning of the hunt or something like that.
Yeah. How about the second morning of the hunt? So on the once in a lifetime, yeah. And if you got 18, 19 points, not such a big deal. You're going to draw it again next year. If you got two,
it's a big bummer. Deal.
And that's why we kind of talked about that a little bit. But some people, you know, kind of some of the internal discussion as well, how long does it take to draw a San Juan bull elk, you know? Isn't that a once in a lifetime too? And so to leave it consistent, we just said preference point species, you know, here's the rule, bonus point, here's the rule, and some of these other categories, here's the extension. There's not a right or wrong. This is all about social considerations, really. So.
Other questions? The loss.
You're out of comment on the question.
Sure.
You ready for comments?
Yes.
You want me to go to the mic?
Well, we can hand you a mic right here if you'd like to capture it for the minute. Somebody hand him a mic. Thanks.
I'll probably be the first guy to break a leg going out on a sheep hunt. But I've seen this kind of thing go on for 35 years here, and the fear that I have is that once we start on this kind of agreement, it grows. And I'm just really worried that there's some really creative people amongst us who can turn this into a real mess by taking advantage of it when it shouldn't be. And so I guess my recommendation is, if they haven't been on the mountain, if the hunt hasn't started, and they want to turn their tag back so they can get a chance again, then I'd support that. But I'd hate to see you let them start and then quit for any reason.
So not one day?
Not one day. And I know that's kind of bitter, but I just worry that where that's going to take us in the next and the next.
Thank you. Other discussion by the RAC? That is exactly what I've seen the board struggle with, is what is an opportunity in it. You know, so some folks articulate scouting, some a morning and afternoon. It's really a tough call.
I like the one day because the division closes on a Friday. The hunt opens on a Saturday. So if you have an accident between Friday night and Saturday, I mean, at least you can go in there and say, look, I never went on the mountain, or I went on it. I mean, I like the one day. It's cutting it clear. I like what you've done saying, hey, if it doesn't fall under this criteria, the board can't even see it. That way you're stopping it before it can get to them, and then you're saving a lot of people's time on the board. So I like that part of it. I it is hard to swallow the once in a lifetime, but you have a great point with the San Juan Elk Ridge or the Beaver Mountain Elk Tag. Those are essentially turning into once in a lifetime, hunts. So I would make a recommendation to pass this rule as presented. Except for on the last page where it says 2 days, it should just say 1 day.
Thanks, Brian. Motion by Brian. Second by Rusty. Any discussion on that motion? Sam?
Just one thing to clarify my mind. We're already doing these variances and have been for some time. Isn't that true? And this is just to kind of streamline the process so we don't have to go back and forth and try to decide some of the things that determine whether they get the variance or not?
The biggest single thing, if I said, there's a lot of little changes here, but the biggest single thing is we're going to get move away from everybody who gets injured or something happens and gets to move it into next year. We're going to just reset and give you your points back. There's a lot of little things, Denver days and this and that, but the main thing is we don't want to get to where we're pushing a lot of seasons into the stacking them on top, especially on some of these once-in-a-lifetime species. You know, adding a couple of sheep onto a unit might be a really big deal, you know. And so they're doing classifications and different things at times of year. And if we've allowed some animals to live, but secretly we've got some permits building on the other side of there, they're going to be shooting them. It's not a big problem yet, but you saw that growth pattern that I showed. It could become a problem a few years from now. So that's probably the biggest single thing we're addressing here.
I don't usually get to vote, but it also levels the playing field and sets some major parameters on what's appealable to the board. We ready to vote? Those in favor? Any against? That looked unanimous. That's a meeting. Any other topics? I don't have any other business. Motion to adjourn.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adjourn.